You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
If you look at all the leaders, you know, from Peter the Great to Yeltsin, all of them, were constantly thinking about the West and what the West does and Europe, 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 Europe. That was the big thing. The important, you know, direction was westward. The people around Putin think very differently. They see the South, they see the East, including Siberia, and they even see the North, the Arctic Circle, which they think is extremely important. So they want to shift Russia away towards another civilizational model, and they also believe that the Russian values should be different from the ones that the West advocates. So it's a desire for a uniqueness of fully fostering a distinct, separate Russian civilizational realm.
This is Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Andrei Rajevsky, who blogs as The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. The Saker was born in a military family of white Russian refugees in Western Europe, where he lived most of his life. After completing two college degrees in the United States, he returned to Europe, where he worked as a military analyst until he lost his career due to his vocal opposition to the Western-sponsored wars in Chechnya, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. After retraining as a software engineer, he returned to the United States, where he now lives with his family. He has been blogging since 2007 as The Saker, and his analytical essays are now widely distributed on the Internet. He is the author of The Essential Saker, From the Trenches of the Emerging Multipolar World. Today we discuss the uniqueness of Russia, both its historical differences and similarities with the West, 300 years of Western domination, the Soviet period, the wars in Chechnya, Russian military defenses, and Atlantic integration versus Eurasian sovereignty. Saker, welcome to the show again.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
In your article, Searching for Russia, you write that Russia is different in a profound and unique way. Being an heir to the Eastern Roman Empire, also known as Byzantium, Russian roots are in antiquity, as opposed to the West, whose roots, according to you, are in the Middle Ages. Could you explain this history?
Oh, we're talking about a long chunk of, we're talking about practically a millennium and more even, but I'll try to make it simple and short. Basically, first of all, Rome and the Western civilization and the consciousness, we're taught that Rome was sacked in 410 AD and the Western Roman Empire 476. And after that began the Middle Ages. Well, for Russia, that sequence doesn't work at all, because what happened is that the Roman Empire was separated in two parts, an Eastern and a Western one. And in the West, we're told that there's a Byzantine Empire. But if you look closer at it, there was never such thing as a Byzantine Empire. There was simply a Roman Empire that continued to exist. The very same Roman Empire, not a different entity, continued to exist in the East and existed until the fall of the Constantinople in 1453. In other words, the first thing to realize is that the Roman Empire did not end in the 5th century. It survived by a full 1,000 years. So while Europe was undergoing the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, Rome continued to exist. And that Rome played a crucial role in Russian history and culture, because it is really what I would say the arrival of Roman Christianity is what created the Russian nation. There were different, I don't mean that in an ethnical sense, I mean that in a cultural sense. At the end of the 10th century, a Russian ruler named Vladimir accepted to become a Christian. He became an Orthodox Christian, an Eastern Christian. And Rome basically infused Russia with its, at least, religious tradition. And that that tradition was passed on to Russia. And if we call Rome antiquity, because there never were any Middle Ages, properly speaking, in Russia, there was also no Renaissance, which is, if you want, the emergence from the Middle Ages. So what we have is a country that was founded by the infusion of Roman civilization into it, that never had any Middle Ages or a Renaissance, and that went basically from antiquity, you could argue, straight into modernity, because the fact that the process, which was so strong and important for the Western history, which is the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, simply never happened in Russia. And to strengthen that also differentiation, another thing happened is that to the degree that the Roman civilization played a key role in the founding of Russia as a culture, the founding of Russia as a state is also due to a process which the West didn't know, which is the invasion coming from the east of the Tatar-Mongol Empire, who occupied Russia and who stayed there for 250 years. And basically, that is what united different Russian princes into one state. And I would say that the Russian state, in terms of its polity, military tactics, etc., was a product of the Tatar-Mongol Empire. So we have Roman origins spiritually and Tatar-Mongol origins in a political sense. That's dramatically different from what the history of the Western Europeans was during the same time period. So while Russians are externally, they look European because they're mostly white, you know, they don't have a different skin color, I would argue that they're extremely different culturally.
That's very interesting. I was just about to ask you how significant was the Asian Tatar Mongol invaders in the creation of the modern Russian state. And I guess you're saying that it was quite significant.
It was extremely significant. First of all, the ancient Russia lost about half of its population. It was a very brutal period for Russia. And the original cities of ancient Russia, for instance, the best known is Kiev, suffered tremendously. And new cities appeared that were capable of resisting that. They learned from their occupiers and then eventually kicked them out. And the Tatars forced upon the Russian nation, forced the political model upon that nation to make it possible for that nation to resist and eventually prevail, which is what happened.
You write that the brand of Christianity received by Russia was the Roman, not the Frankish one. What
Correct.
Is the difference? What's the Frankish one?
This is what in the West would be called Roman Catholicism or Western Christianity or Latin Christianity. And this is a key to understand why there were so many wars between, I shouldn't say wars between Russia and the West, but I should say why there were so many attempts by the West to subdue and conquer Russia, is that Russia practically from its foundation was in opposition to the West in terms of its values, civilizational outlook, ethos. I mean, Russians never were truly part of the Western culture. Now, I know some people are going to be shocked when I say that because they're going to say, what are you talking about? What about Tchaikovsky? What about Dostoevsky? What about, you know, so many, how shall I put it, representatives of the Russian culture that played such a big role and were very much influenced by the West? If you look at the architecture of St. Petersburg, the penetration of Masonic ideas in the Russian aristocracy, that is all true. There was a profound interpenetration between the West and Russia, but that interpenetration affected primarily the elites, the aristocracy, the court. So it was, this was a reality at the top, not at all at the bulk of the Russian nation. The 90% of the Russians were not involved in that process at all. So that also creates an interesting dynamic, an alienation and a profound alienation of the masses versus their elites. It took a dramatic turn during the 17th century on an internal Orthodox dispute where I don't want to go into complicated dogmatic issues here, but I would just say that the people had one outlook on Orthodoxy and most of the elite another one, although I'm simplifying that. Some of the elites, you know, were on the other side, et cetera. There was basically, I would say, a schism, a chasm breaking open and gradually getting bigger and bigger and bigger between the rulers of Russia, starting with particularly Peter I, the early late 17th century, up to the revolution. So there was tensions vertically in Russia and tensions east versus west.
You have started to explain this, but how have the Russian ruling elites differed from the Russian people, particularly in the last 300 years?
Well, a couple of things happened at the same time. Peter the First wanted to change the face of Russia, as he would have put it, and his supporters do, to modernize it and open it to the West. I would simply say westernize. Why not use that term? A lot of the old elites were at that moment moved away. The old aristocracy, for instance, the old nobility, was moved away from the centers of power. He created a much more recent new aristocracy and ruling class. At the same time, he introduced a number of reforms which profoundly alienated the people in their culture and their religious feelings and the way the society should work. I mean, things which can look funny, you know, when we speak nowadays. For instance, having beards. For Orthodox Christians, it's very important for men to have a beard because this is how it's, you know, you're supposed to uphold the image and likeness and image to God that the way you were created. Well, Peter the Great said it's a barbaric thing, that wisdom is not in a beard but in the brain, and he forced a lot of people to shave their beards. For the Russians of that period, that was very traumatic and very insulting. So and it manifested itself in that kind of things. Secondly, of course, there's the fact that, how would you call that in English? Suddenly I have a word that's missing me. I missed a word here. Krepostnoye pravo, and it means serfdom. Serfdom, there we go. Serfdom was also something that profoundly alienated many Russian people. So there were event after event after event which gradually broke more and more the masses from the elites. And I would add something paradoxical here. A lot of czars perceived that and wanted to defend and had that sensitivity to try to, I would say, represent or cater to or be concerned for what the masses wanted. And that created yet another problem, the opposition between the monarchs and the aristocrats, which is very much overlooked in Western historiography. There's always an assumption that there's the monarch and the court and the aristocracy, and they're all together. You know, it's absolutely not true. In Russian history, monarchs were typically, the principle of aristocracy and monarchy were opposed to each other, and a lot of monarchs were killed because of that. So yet again, this schism in Russian culture and the Russian nation created yet another tension now among the elites. So it's a multi-layered cake of contradictions which exploded eventually truly dramatically in the 20th century.
What was the point you were making about serfdom alienating the masses?
Well, for instance, serfdom basically was, generally feudalism was an import from the West. Russians are, and have been in history, very freedom-loving, and bordering on the anarchist tendencies were very strong. You know, self-determination, autonomy, local rule, self-rule. There were very, very numerous examples of self-rule by cities or by group of people. That's, for instance, how the Cossacks had it. The famous Cossacks were very highly autonomous in their culture and very jealous of that freedom. So when the center tried to impose feudalism and serfdom upon the Russian people, a lot of Russians fled. They fled to the borderlands where it was safer and you were further away from the central powers. Others went to Siberia. The same thing when I mentioned that schism inside the Orthodox Church. To make it very simple, there was an old rite and a new rite. I'm not going to go into details of what separated the two. A lot of the old ritualists actually emigrated from Russia. They went from all sorts of countries. Some went to Turkey. Some went eventually even to the United States, and even South America still has nowadays different groups who fled that authoritarian central power in Russia.
I'm speaking with author and analyst, The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that there is no way to consider the Soviet period as a continuation of the pre-1917 Russia. Do you consider the Russian revolutions of 1917 as a complete break with historical Russia?
Yes, but I have to say, first of all, there are two revolutions in 1917. There's a first break in February of 1917. There was a coup organized by the elites against the Tsar. And then in October or November, by the old calendar, there's yet another revolution where the Bolsheviks seize power from the Democrats. So the Bolsheviks, contrary to what people, mostly people think, never overthrew the Tsar. they overthrew this Masonic garment of a gentleman named Kerensky, who was representing typically what we today would call the oligarchy or the globalist, oligarchs. That's what they were, really. Very wealthy, rich people. Remember I told you that the elites after Peter had a different agenda than the czars, and that was typical. So the first oligarchy overthrew the czar, and then the Bolsheviks overthrew the oligarchs. And yes, it is a break, though it has certain common features with the traditional Russia. It's impossible to completely say that there's no continuity. After all, it's the same cities, the same language, the people were involved. But on a philosophical level, I would compare that difference. The image that I always use is a healthy tissue versus a malignant tumor. A tumor shares a lot of the DNA with the tissue that it came from, yet it has crucial differences, and these crucial differences are sufficient in many cases to actually kill the host that is suffering from that condition. And that's what communism and the Soviet period was for Russia. It was an anti-Russia, but with a certain degree of commonality on the DNA, definitely. For instance, the values of community, of collectivism, of fairness. I mean, all these ideas are very much rooted in Russian culture. So the communists were not stupid, and they didn't come up with only things that would shock Russians. They said, we'll give the land back to the people, back freedom, abolish inequalities. All these things speak profoundly to the Russian culture, but it comes in an atheist mold, for instance. The virulent atheism of the Bolsheviks was something that profoundly shocked Russia, which traditionally was a very religious and pious society. Secondly, a lot of the early generation of Bolsheviks were ethnic Jews. And careful here, there's also a mistake that people make. The fact that a majority of Bolsheviks were Jews does not mean the majority of Jews were Bolsheviks. A majority of pre-revolutionary Russian Jews were not Bolsheviks. They were usually socialists, Mensheviks, and Bundists, and all sorts of different parties. But it is true, and even Putin recently confirmed that, speaking in front of a group of Orthodox rabbis in Moscow, he said about 80 to 85% of the first-generation Bolsheviks were Jews. And that's factually true, and these people were extremely Russophobic. They hated the Russian culture, which they saw as anti-Semitic. They hated Christianity, and Orthodoxy was a very traditional form of Christianity. So even though most of traditionally anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews was something that you saw more often in what is today the Ukraine, which is southern Western Russia, when the Bolsheviks seized power, they truly opened a persecution. I would say that I think there was an attempt to really truly commit a cultural genocide of Russia by these people. So when you have that happening, you can't say that this is just a continuity of the same old regime under a new heading or wrapping.
Do you believe that the 1917 revolution, that is the second one, the communist revolution, was not inherently Russian but imported from the West?
Oh, yeah, there's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, Trotsky was an agent of the United States. Lenin had contacts with the Germans. It was definitely an import. What happened was that basically once the oligarch or the liberals or the Democrats, if you want to call them, took power, the country went into such a degree of chaos that I would compare that to somebody which has a severe immune deficiency. And it wasn't that hard to infect it with something. And the most organized, I would say the intellectually superior group, actually, were definitely the Bolsheviks. If you look at the writings of Lenin or Trotsky, these guys are smart. They had a vision. They had a plan. They had a global explanation of what's happening in history. When I compare them to the infinite mediocrity of the non-entities who took power early that year, the Democrats, it's no surprise that they lost power, 8 months after seizing it. They were just good enough to destroy the empire. That's all they could do. They couldn't build or fix anything.
You write that, quote, in a cultural and spiritual sense, the Russian nation was oppressed to various degrees roughly between 1666 and 1999. That is 330 years, a long period by any standards. How would you characterize this oppression?
I would say, first of all, you shouldn't take those dates, as a instant binary switch from non-oppression to oppression and then back again. So it's just rough dates. I chose them because they were symbolic of two events. One is the Council of the Russian Orthodox Church in 1666 or 1667, which I think played a catastrophic role in the history of the Russian Orthodox Church, and 1999 is the coming to power of Putin. So that's where I took those two figures. That oppression was basically that throughout these years, a different civilizational model was imposed upon the Russian people. It was the Western aristocratic model. Then it was the Western oligarchic model. Then I call it Western, the Western Bolshevik Marxist model. And then at the last end, we had again a return to the rule of the oligarchs during the Yeltsin years. During all those years, the top of the country, I would say there were moments where, of course, it's fluctuates. Some were much more patriotic than others, much more respectful than others of Russian culture. And some rulers were profoundly, you know, not interested in the Russian culture or hated it even. So it's not uniform. I would say that probably for the first time, most Russians felt that the person in power in Russia represented them and not some kind of elite above them. I would say it's probably Vladimir Putin.
You write that for the first time in centuries, the ruler of the Kremlin is not somebody whom the West can hope to subdue or co-opt. Hence the hysterical paranoia about Putin and his evil Ruskies. Are you amazed at the histrionics in the press and by everyone else about Russia and Putin?
No, actually, I'm not. I mean, I'm amazed that they actually do it, but somewhere I am not, because it makes sense. I mean, you have to realize that look at the history of Western attempts to subdue, invade, occupy, you know, and enslave Russia. A lot of them happened during the years when Russia was weak due to those internal contradictions. I mean, I would say, for instance, Russia had major problems internally during the Napoleonic Wars. Russia had major problems internally during the Crimean War. Russia had fantastic problems during the First World War, which was stopped because of the revolution. But had there not been a revolution, Russia would have won that one also. So what happens is the West truly fears a united Russia. There would be a profound bond linking the people, the masses, and the person in power, which is today's Putin. He embodies that. And this is simply a country that is going to say flat out, no, we are not going to follow your model. And Putin has been outspoken about that. He's the first person that I'm aware of, certainly in the West, that has marked people, that says not only that we disagree on specific tactical issues, we actually reject your civilizational model. Now, there have been others. There have been, for instance, part of the Muslim world, particularly the Iranian Islamic Republic, has rejected the Western model. There is a model in Latin America, you know, 21st century socialism or Chavism and all that movement. There are different movements that challenge the Western cultural supremacy and legitimacy even. But Russia is the one that comes armed with nuclear weapons, the largest country on Earth, the largest reserves of, you know, fossil fuel and all sorts of riches. It makes it very powerful. And the West is frightened because Russia, it is true that Napoleon, his attack ended up with Russians in the center of Paris, and Hitler, you know, essentially brought the Russians to downtown Berlin. So there is a fear, I think, a very profound fear that Russia could eventually strike out and finally, you know, if not attack, that at least crush the empire by refusing to be subdued. And I think that fear is founded. I think this is a founded fear, and I think this is exactly what we're witnessing today. I think the simple fact of existing independently is a mortal threat to the world hegemon.
Has Russia ever lost a war? And could you mention some of the very big wars against Russia? There have been so many, I can't keep them straight.
There's a lot of them. I would say that's the closest thing to a loss of a war, I would say, is the Crimean War. although even that is complicated. The consequences were pretty rapidly mitigated. I would argue that Russia won against Japan, and I know that most Japanese historians see it that way, but in the West, it's considered that this was a war that Russia lost. Russia can definitely lose battles, and even sometimes wars take a very long time until they prevail. They fought a long time against the Swedes, for instance. So it's not that Russia is necessarily invincible, but I think that Russia is truly inconquerable to begin with due to geography. And secondly, I do think that the Russian culture is so profoundly filled with military ethos and tradition that it really creates a different kind of soldier. It's hard to explain in a couple of words, but the mindset of the Russian soldier is very different from the mindset of the Western soldier. It's sort of a cultural thing. It's collectivism again. It's the willingness to sacrifice your life for the greater good. That's why you see the kind of resistance that you saw, for instance, during World War II in horrible battles that Western military simply never provided.
You've written that every one of those wars was accompanied by a frenzied Russia bashing campaign in the media and literature, and all these wars were represented as being fought in the name of lofty European values against mm-hmm. the barbaric hordes, etc.
Sure.
You also say that in the years when Russia was not the object of a military attack, she was always the object of economic sanctions under one pious pretext or another. Now, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because Russia, for instance, well, we take a short survey, for instance. There was something called a Northern Crusade. It was when the papacy decided to either subdue or forcibly convert or kill all the Orthodox people in the East. At that time, from a traditionalist papist point of view, Orthodox Christians are considered schismatics, rebels against the Holy Father, and that has been an ancient dream of Latin Christianity to finally, in one way or another, absorb Orthodox Christianity. So that's, you could say, the Western religious vendetta. Then comes the political one. After Freemasonry truly gained power in the UK and in France, Russia was seen as the backward, obscurantist monarchy, Christian monarchy, that was considered a threat to the Western order. So therefore, again, Russia became a target. And a large part of the Russian aristocracy actually even became members of the various Masonic lodges. And yet, when the war broke out between Russia and France, those very same Russians actually went and fought and died. So even those westernized, and that's not English, but I will say it, Masonicized Russian aristocracy, they still fought for their country. And if you read War and Peace, you see that there's real patriotism, even amongst those circles. So that was, again, a defeat of the ideology of the day in the West. Then we have, of course, the episode with Hitler, who wanted to create a united Europe, who had the same exact rhetoric as today the Ukrainians, which is, there's those Asian Mongol hordes in the East, and we have to protect Western civilization against those barbarians. And he added on top of that a racial theory which said that Russians were subhumans, Untermensch, and he had this drive to the East to give new lands to the master race. These things that today sound ridiculous for us, but let's be honest, that was the mainstream Western ideology in World War II. There's a reason why Hitler took all of Europe without much of an effort, let's be honest. So that was the order of the day, and again Russia resisted. And now we went to the period after that where democracy, Western capitalism became the big ideology, and Russia was communist. Yet again, you had to defend the free world against the commies. There's always a very justifiable and ideological explanation, which not only permeates the newspapers, but eventually permeates literature and the general consciousness. I mean, I really think there is an anti-Russian racism in many circles in the West. I've seen it myself many times, particularly when people don't know that I myself am Russian. I've heard it. I've seen it. That's there. It's a mix. And phobia in two senses, of both fear and loathing. It's a combination of both.
I'm speaking with author and analyst, The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. you've written that gradually and insidiously, the hatred and fear of Russia became part of the Western cultural identity. And you've already basically been talking about this. Don't you think that this is pathological?
You know, it's hard for me to judge, to speak of a pathology of an entire mix of society, because the West is not uniform. That I should actually say, that's actually probably a very important point. What I described is mostly Northern European, at least the recent phenomena. The Southern Europe has been very different in its attitude towards Russia. And I also should have probably mentioned the competition between the British Empire and Russia, who was what prevented, in many instances, the British Empire from ruling the way it wanted. So there was there still is a rabid Russophobia in the English, the British elites nowadays. I would say much stronger than the United States, even. So I don't think it's a pathology. I think it's a consequence of a history where there's no clear natural border. Russians are white. They speak an Indo-European language, which is close to, you know, other Slavic languages and further to the west, like Polish or Serbian or Bulgarian. So on one hand, Russian look, I was speaking as a non-Russian now, I take that hat on. They're kind of like us, but then they're frustratingly not like us. They always end up not doing the right thing. So people get frustrated. And secondly, they judge the Russian people, the Russian culture, by purely Western standards. And of course, they get it wrong. It's very interesting for me during the Cold War to observe that the biggest authorities on Russia and the Soviet Union were almost without exception people who profoundly hated Russia and hated the Russian culture. I think of Richard Pipes as a perfect example of that kind of Russophobe. I would stress, by the way, if somebody's interested, that Professor Stephen Cohen is probably right now one of the best specialists on Russia in the United States, and he does not, repeat, not at all display that anti-Russian character that most Russian specialists or Soviet specialists during the Cold War were almost always showing. You know, the Russians were bad guys. You could really tell that. He does not. So I highly recommend him. I respect the man. And whatever he says today is very always worthy to listen to. So, yeah, I think there is a global, you know, this has been going on for centuries, roughly a millennium. And that's a lot of conflict. And it ends up, you know, building the image of an enemy. Sadly, but true.
Earlier, you made reference to Western Freemasonry. What would be a simple explanation of Freemasonry?
I think there's an impossibility of simply explaining in a rapidly what Freemasonry is. I would say it is, without going into details, it is a worldview first and foremost. It used to be an organization, of course, still is. But it is the idea of progress, of civilization, of rational thinking. It's a very specific approach to religion, which I don't want to characterize here. It is the ideas of enlightenment. Basically, it's the mainstream ideology today. The values of the century today right now come straight out of Masonic lodges. But honestly, I cannot give a quick answer. I mean, that would take a full hour to even begin to outline. It's a very complex phenomenon, and it was different in different countries. You know, the French Masonry is not the British, is not the Russian, is not the Italian. They're all very different. It's not the American. So it's a very complex. I cannot, you know, summarize into one, but I would just say that this ideology at its core is profoundly anti-Christian, is profoundly anti-monarchist, and that a lot of Russian, it is something that's typically an ideology for the elites. At least it was. It was the people who self-identified themselves as being the elites, the thinkers, those who think free, who are free from prejudices and, you know, obscurantist prejudice that usually they would say are in religious circles or monarchist circles.
You've written that Putin's rule is a kind of very traditional Russian neo-monarchy, and that Putin mm-hmm. has found a way to combine the external forms of democracy with the internal characteristics of Russian monarchy. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes. I would make a comparison. It's not a perfect one, but just to illustrate the point, look at modern Japan, or even more Japan during, you know, the 70s probably. You had a country which is a democracy, but really the country is run, the moral authority of the emperor is extremely high. And that is the same thing that's happening today in Russia. For the first time, I would say, if I had to say where the real center of power of Putin is, it is the popular consensus behind him. And he's extremely aware of it, and he caters to it very directly. He reaches out on a regular basis, and he's very skillful at that. For instance, it's very interesting, he has very long shows, at least once a year, which is a call-in shows where people call in or write in, and the audience ask some questions. And the kind of language he uses is a very popular one. He tries, I think he's not misrepresenting himself. He's just presenting himself as somebody that is close to the people. And the people actually believe it this time around. All rulers always try to do that, but I don't think very many were successful, at least not in Russia. So I think it's Solzhenitsyn who said that the spectrum of all powers range from regimes whose authority is based on strength to those whose strength is based on authority. And I would say that the strength of the Putin regime is based on its moral authority with the people, far more than the outcome of an election or, what kind of money he has or doesn't have or the political party that supposedly is the main party backing him. It's much more complicated than that. And I think that caters to a need Russians identify and like that. Russia is a country that has to be led by a strong person, for sure. But it has to be a person that people feel is on the side of the people and not, trying to cater to the agenda of the wealthy elites.
You write that the Chechen leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, created a personal guard for Vladimir Putin. What is that all about?
It's absolutely true. He did. I mean, it wasn't very much commented, but what he did is... he took basically most of the elite forces, I think there was 10,000 people at that time, in a stadium. It's on the internet, you can find that. I have it on my blog somewhere. And he basically, these people resigned their commission altogether officially so as to not be bound by their legal obligations and swore essentially an oath of allegiance to Vladimir Putin as a person. Not to the president of Russia. Kadyrov clearly said that. He said, this is a guard that is at the service of Vladimir Putin, and anywhere you tell us to go, whatever orders you tell us to fulfill, we will do it. Buddy, if you can interrupt here, if you want, I can look up that quote and quote him more accurately. Do you want me to find that?
Oh, okay, sure.
Okay, so here is what I'm quoting now, direct translation of the words of the leader of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov. He said, "Today I repeat the words of Ahmad Haji, which is his father, who was murdered by terrorists." And he continues, he says, "It's time to make an informed choice. And we say to the entire world that we're the combat infantry of Vladimir Putin. If we receive an order, we're actually prove that this is so. For 15 years, Putin has been helping our people. Now, you and I, and we have 10,000 of people specially trained, ask the national leader of Russia to consider us a special voluntary unit of the commander-in-chief, ready to defend Russia and the stability of her borders, accomplish a combat mission of any complexity. We realize that our country has regular army, air force, navy, and nuclear forces. However, there are tasks that can be solved only by volunteers, and we will solve them," unquote. So this is absolutely fascinating because a number of things. It came to almost a genocide of Chechens, I would say, during the two wars between Russia and Chechnya, when Chechnya was ruled by Wahhabis, extremists. And what happened was a very unique phenomenon in history. Two men decided to trust each other to stop that, Putin and the father of Ramzan Kadyrov, Ahmad Haji Kadyrov. And the Chechen nation, it's amazing. Chechens used to be despised as being, those Wahhabi terrorists, etc. Now they're even fighting in the Donbass, defending, Russian Orthodox people, although they're themselves Muslims, against the Ukrainian Nazi death squads. I mean, that's how much it changed it. And Putin is extremely popular in Chechnya, as is the leader of Chechnya. And he basically returned to an old model, which is the model... The Cossacks had the same model, which is basically the central power gives us very large autonomy, that we're responsible for the border and we'll be the shock units defending the country if needed. And that's basically what Chechens nowadays, they play a central role in Russian special forces, for instance, who have fully integrated Chechen special forces inside the Russian ones. We've seen them in Syria. They were before in Lebanon. Chechen volunteers fight in the Donbass. They became sort of the shock troops, I would say, of Russia as a country. And in that case, Putin never accepted it, of course, because he has to be, you know, function within the bounds of law in Russia. But the message was a very powerful one, which means, you know, if somebody tries to, say, organize a revolution in Russia, I'm going to send 10,000 of my men to protect Putin as a person. And if you look at the video on my website, it's subtitled in English. You take a good look at the guys that showed up at that stadium. These are tough, tough, tough soldiers. You don't want to fight them. Chechens, even when Russians hated them during the war against the Wahhabis, never did the Russians say that Chechens are cowards or weak. They're extremely tough. So that is the new function of Chechnya. It is the Chechens have become sort of the policemen of the Caucasus, and they would be at the forefront, for instance, if the Wahhabi insurgency in Syria and Iraq, if it suddenly turned north in the worst case at all, Chechens would be absolutely forefront of fighting that. They are now, the entire military of the Chechens is sort of an elite force, and because they're Muslims, it's much more intelligent to use them in Muslim countries because there's a brotherhood between Muslims that non-Muslims would not share.
Well, how did the Wahhabis get in control of Chechnya in the first place?
It was, yet again, thanks to the Democrats. Just as the Bolsheviks seized Russia easily when Kerensky was in power, during the time of Yeltsin, there was such a chaos that people were disgusted with the center. And it's important to remember, Yeltsin had just, organized a bloodbath in Moscow in 1993 against the parliament. He basically did a completely illegal coup, and the West applauded him, of course, enthusiastically for quote-unquote restoring democracy. The regime that he put in power was corrupt to an infinite degree, and it was a violent regime. It began by disagreements on the proceeding that the money that would come from gas and oil in Chechnya. And basically, the regime around Yeltsin said, we're not going to negotiate with these people. We'll just crush them militarily. What they had forgotten is that it's one thing to shoot at a parliament with tanks in Moscow and quite another to fight a small nation, admittedly, but an extremely tough one. I don't wish anybody to fight against the Chechens. And on top of that, because the locals were so corrupt, the Chechens had inherited a huge amount of weapons from the Soviet military that they took under their control when they declared independence. The city of Grozny was a very heavily built, strong city with several fortified centers at the center of the city where they could fight very well. And the Chechens were motivated. They were not only motivated by Wahhabism, they also didn't want to deal with the kind of regime that was in Moscow. So the Wahhabis, they came in there, they injected themselves there, just as they injected themselves in Syria, for instance, and in other places. They felt that this is a moment, there's a crisis, let's inject ourselves into that. And they gradually seized power by the usual methods of propaganda, corruption, and violence within the Chechen opposition, let's call it this way to not characterize it. And the worse the Russian onslaught began, the more people in Chechnya first went, you know what, these guys are fighting for us. Let's fight on their, I mean, we'd rather have them than the Federals. So what happened then is, again, the same thing as in Syria, very similar. Eventually, the Wahhabis began their crazy stuff that they usually do everywhere, which is, you know, slave markets, torture, Sharia law applied in a completely primitive way, terror. I mean, they began to do all the stuff that we see in Syria, and that's when the Chechen population said, no, we don't want that. And that's when the person, Ahmad Haji Kadyrov, and then his son came in, who said, basically, let's stop this war. It has to be stopped. We will get rid of the Wahhabis, which they did. But we also want our Muslim traditions to be fully respected, which they are. And they want not only cultural and economic autonomy, but the center, because Putin did understand how important that was, poured billions of rubles into rebuilding Grozny, which was flattened to the ground completely. Now it's one of the most prosperous cities. It's beautifully been rebuilt. So these two men basically at the last second changed the course of history, which could have been horrible.
I'm speaking with author and analyst, The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, the Wahhabi takeover of Chechnya was supported by the U.S. CIA, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, very much. And by the entire West. I mean, at that time, the European Parliament was receiving delegation of course, Chechen, what else? Freedom fighters. They didn't call them good terrorists then. They didn't call them Mujahideen, but they were, you know, freedom fighters and, you know, independentists, etc. The West was completely to the hilt pro-Chechen. Nobody cared about the horrors, the torture, the atrocities committed against Russian people first, and then against Chechen people by the Wahhabis. Nobody cared. The West got a little bit disgusted when the first English technicians who were building cell towers in Chechnya began being decapitated, kidnapped, tortured. So when it hit eventually Western expat, there was sort of a little cold that happened. But as long as these guys were butchering the locals, the West was giving them a standing ovation. It's absolutely disgusting.
In your article, The Best Armed Forces on the Planet, you say that Russia is now the most powerful country on the planet because of two things: Russian rejection of the post-World War II U.S. worldwide hegemony and what it represents, and because of Vladimir Putin's rock-solid support of the Russian people. How does the Russian rejection of the U.S. model make Russia powerful?
It makes Russia powerful out of proportion with her actual power economically or militarily, because it sets a moral, it puts Russia in a position of moral leadership of resistance. If you look, it all began with a speech, I think, in 2007 in Munich by Putin, who, you know, basically told the West bluntly in its face the truth about the hypocrisy of its behavior, contradiction, what we discussed last time between what it's supposed to stand for, what it really stands for. More recently, we had the speech by Putin in the UN where he said, "Do you even understand what you have done?" Speaking about the Middle East. The fact that Russians say that, and for instance, the Chinese never do, even though economically they're infinitely more powerful than the relatively small Russian economy, puts Russia in a unique position, which is the one to be the spokesman, the not the leader in an organizational sense, but objectively we see it today again in Syria. Russia is the country, the only one that can actually stop the U.S. in its tracks. And the Russians are willing to do that. Now, they're not doing that because, by the way, when I say they're willing to do that, I don't think they have much of an option. Most people realize in Russia that giving in and submitting to the Western demands is essentially turning Russia into Ukraine. They don't want that. They see what's happening to Ukraine across the border. They say, God forbid. They remember the 1990s, and there's just no way they're going to let that happen. So they took a stance, a firm one, already when the West one was on the borders of Russia. It didn't happen very early. When it was Serbia who was hit, you know, Primakov turned his airplane in the air. The foreign minister flew back, and Russia protested, but that was about it, because it was an extremely weak country run by pro-Western a puppet regime. During the Medvedev years, Russia actually voted to put sanctions on Iran and even allowed a limited operation over Libya. I mean, the terms did not allow the West to do what it did, but it said all necessary means to implement the resolution, and after that, we had the breakup of Libya. Russia woke up late. And now she literally is fighting for her survival. But she did wake up, and she was willing to fight. Other countries are not even willing to fight for their survival. And I would put in that category all of Western Europe. They don't even have the spine to try to resist. Russia does.
You debunk some popular myths about military strength, including the importance of numbers, high technology, and lots of expensive equipment. Could you talk about this in the context of the present-day Russian military? How would you characterize it?
I would say that the biggest strength of the Russian military today is that the strategy, tactics, force planning, everything that the Russian armed forces do today is commensurate with the capabilities of Russia and is limited to defense. In other words, it's the opposite of what the U.S. does. U.S. has overreached over the entire planet, has anywhere between 700 to 1,000 military bases worldwide. That's why the U.S. spends such a huge amount of money on aggression. The Russians have absolutely no desire, contrary to what the neocons say, to be an empire. They've done it. They've paid too much a price. Russia has a purely defensive posture, has a very limited power projection capability. Actually, you can see that by the Russian operation Syria, which in terms of numbers is actually very limited. And the truth is the Russian armed forces are not organized to operate that far, sustain a military operation that far, as far as Syria. That's really the edge. Really what they're designed to do is to prevail in a belt about 500 to 1,000 kilometers out on the, across the perimeter of the Russian border, which is much more limited. It's much more defensive. So what makes them that strong is that basically they're relying on the home advantage. Geography plays a huge very to the Russian advantage. The fact that in order to hit the Russians, you have to get close to them is actually, in military terms, a huge advantage for Russia. So for what it does, I think it's one of the best militaries, or the best one right now in the world, because of the kind of task it is given. It could never send, you know, an expeditionary force to Mexico or invade Uruguay or something like that. But they don't even try. That's the big thing. They use limited resources to make sure that they can achieve a very limited means. And that means is to win a war against any opponent, including the US or NATO, in defense of Russia on the air and land and sea. And if it gets a nuclear war, it is in full parity with the United States. I would actually give an advantage to Russian nuclear forces. So that is a perfect combination, having advanced forces, very highly motivated troops that changed a lot since the Chechen years, where they couldn't even bring together a brigade. They couldn't create a single real brigade. They had to glue it together from smaller units. Now all Russian units are a high degree of readiness. They're all equipped with modern gear. By 2020, they're supposed to have 70% of only modern gear everywhere across the Russian armed forces. So they're actually doing very well. And the key thing, again, is that their objectives will never be something that is beyond what they could actually do.
What is the difference between Atlantic integration as opposed to Eurasian sovereignty? You have written that the group behind Medvedev is the Atlantic integrationists and the people behind Putin, the Eurasian sovereigntists.
Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental difference that really influences everything that happens in Russia today. So let's go back to the arrival of Putin to power. Right before him, we had the regime of Yeltsin, which was an absolute disaster, a catastrophe. The country was literally breaking apart. I think Russia could have broken actually in two parts in the late 1990s. It was an absolute apocalypse. So what happened? Two groups, very different groups, got together and said, okay, we need to do something about it. On one hand, it was big money, oil industry, gas industry, you know, all the money group, the people. And that's Medvedev, and the people who pushed on Putin, who were the Foreign Intelligence Service, but he really represented, I would say more generally, the security services. And they did a compromise. Something like, I think, was maybe tried with Trump and Pence, which was, we put one of you guys and one of us guys up there, and they sort of will balance each other out. And it worked like that. It was pretty much, on one hand, Dmitry Medvedev was, you know, representing the pro-Western, you know, IMF type. His goal was to have Russia as an equal partner accepted by the West. I mean, he didn't apply for NATO, but I think I would have not put it past him to do that, or to become someone integrated in the European structures. He wanted Russia very much to become like maybe a big Poland or something like that. And the overriding, of course, you know, value of these people is money, money and economics. That's what they're in for. Putin came from a very different background. I would call him an officer. Doesn't really matter that he was a foreign intelligence officer as opposed to a military officer. He comes from what's called in Russia the force ministries. It's the part of the country that, you know, the special services, intelligence community, military, etc. And his view is a dramatically different one. These people are profoundly opposed to the Western civilizational model, have no desire of Russia of becoming, you know, part of the West. They know, for one thing, and know it's futile. They will never be accepted by the West. So their idea is much more to, first of all, re-sovereignize Russia. I don't think that's English, but I use that term, to make Russia fully sovereign again, which she still isn't. And secondly, to not turn Russia's back on the West, but simply stop staring with fixation towards the West. If you look at all the leaders that we discussed earlier in the show, you know, from Peter the Great to Yeltsin, all of them were constantly thinking about the West and what the West does and Europe. And some of them were pro-European, others were less pro-European, but they were still kind of, that was the big thing. The important, you know, direction was westward. The people around Putin think very differently. They see the South, they see the East, including Siberia, and they even see the North, the Arctic Circle, which they think is extremely important. So they want to decouple Russia to a certain degree from the dollar, the Western economy, the Western legal system, and basically just turn, shift Russia away towards another civilizational model. And they also believe that the Russian values should be different from the ones that the West advocates. So it's a pragmatic, it's a cultural, and it's even a spiritual desire for a uniqueness of fully fostering a distinct, separate Russian civilizational realm. And these two groups have been fighting each other. There still are. Now, the problem for the first group, the Atlantic integrationist, is the personal, fantastic popularity of Putin, which is not at all shared by Dmitry Medvedev. He's not that popular. His government is even less popular. So they're keeping a low profile because right now they know it's not a good time for them. But they're still here. And they're definitely the biggest threat for Putin. And they're the ones who constantly sabotage, you know, what he's trying to do. So there's this internal struggle, which is very powerful. And in the last show, I compared it to the kind of struggle that we saw taking place shortly, but very strongly between, you know, the neocons and, I would say, Bannon, Flynn, who were ejected. I mean, the ejections happened less often in Russia, but they're there. I mean, the last score was... Putin scored well. He kicked out the Minister of Economics, which was particularly hated for a long while. So he's getting more and more strong, but he's far from having full control. Very far from that still.
Saker, thank you so much again.
It's a huge pleasure, and thanks to you.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with the Saker. Today's show has been In Search of Russia. The Saker was born in a military family of white Russian refugees in Western Europe, where he lived most of his life. After completing two college degrees in the United States, he returned to Europe, where he worked as a military analyst until he lost his career due to his vocal opposition to the Western-sponsored wars in Chechnya, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. After retraining as a software engineer, he returned to the United States, where he now lives with his family. He has been blogging since 2007 as The Saker, and his essays have attracted a large audience. He is the author of The Essential Saker, From the Trenches of the Emerging Multipolar World. Visit thesaker.is. That's the S-A-K-E-R.is. IS stands for Iceland. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey! Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky, David Rovix, I, and, of all people, Thomas Friedman, talk about energy and the environment. There's some good news and some bad news, and I hope you'll stay tuned. It's been a while since we devoted a show to energy and the environment. Some nice, juicy current events are impossible to resist, though. Some of the news is good, sort of. And, of course, when it comes to the environment, much of the news is bad. Nuclear energy, nuclear bombs, coal, and the destruction of the environment and its creatures are all closely interconnected. And, if the gods permit, we shall hear more from David Rovix, Noam Chomsky, I, and others. Let's start off with some good news about nuclear electricity. In April 2015, an installment of New World Notes was titled Bad Business, Nuclear Power. There, two distinguished commentators argued that nuclear power was not economically viable, never was economically viable, and never will be economically viable. So said both Jeremy Rifkin, the famous management consultant, and David Freeman, a highly experienced power systems administrator. Both men agreed that nuclear power is alive only because the federal government keeps it alive with billions of our tax dollars. The federal government keeps this industry alive for two reasons. One, to keep some big businesses profitable. The other reason, nuclear power is a public fig leaf for the military's nuclear bomb-making program. There are dozens of good arguments against nuclear power. Here's a bunch. Nuclear energy is a massive source of hydrocarbon emissions, when you include the mining and refining of their uranium fuel. Nuclear plants also emit deadly, lethal waste, even when operating normally, and, of course, much more when they explode. There is no good way to store the deadly waste products these plants generate. Jeremy Rifkin brought up an idea that was new to me. There is not enough fresh water in the world to cool any large number of nuclear plants. But in America, where money talks, how's this argument? Every other way of generating electricity is cheaper than nuclear. Coal and oil have always cost less than nuclear. Solar is now at that point, and probably wind, too. Maybe fat cats, who don't care about destroying life on Earth, might be moved at least by this argument. In any semblance of a free market, there's no way you can make a profit on nuclear. Anyway, that was a pretty nice old show of ours. You can grab a copy of it on our website, if you're so inclined. Look for New World Notes number 373, Bad Business, Nuclear Power, from April 2015. You can find our website at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. But back to the present. Just to prove Jeremy Rifkin and David Friedman were right about the economics, here's part of a story from the New York Times, March 30th, 2017. Bankruptcy rocks nuclear industry. And I quote, Westinghouse Electric Company, which helped drive the development of nuclear energy and the electric grid itself, filed for bankruptcy protection on Wednesday, casting a shadow over the global nuclear industry. The filing comes as the company's corporate parent, Toshiba of Japan, scrambles to stanch huge losses stemming from Westinghouse's troubled nuclear construction projects in the American South. Now the future of these projects, which once seemed to be on the leading edge of a renaissance for nuclear energy, is in doubt. Westinghouse, once a proud name that in years past symbolized America's supremacy in nuclear power, now illustrates its problems. Continuing with the story, slowing demand for electricity and tumbling prices for natural gas have eroded the economic rationale for nuclear power, which is extremely costly and technically challenging to develop. Alternative energy sources like wind and solar power are rapidly maturing and coming down in price. The 2011 earthquake in Japan that led to the nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi plant renewed worries about safety. Westinghouse's problems are already reducing Japan's footprint in nuclear power, an industry it has nurtured for decades in the name of energy security. General Electric, a pioneer in the field, also has scaled back its nuclear operations, expressing doubts about their economic viability. Areva, the French builder, is mired in losses and undergoing a large-scale restructuring. Okay, end of text. Ken speaking again now. Further proof of what you heard here 2 years ago. Nuclear power is not going to work economically, just as it doesn't work in a dozen other aspects. Nuclear power is an environmental disaster and a threat to world peace. That will get you a shrug from any capitalist. But, again, the good news, nuclear power is now obviously an economic disaster. And real shareholders are losing real money on this turkey. That's bad news for big power, hence good news for Earth. I confess I do feel a bit of ambivalence here. For one, some innocent people have some pension funds caught up in Westinghouse and Toshiba. Also, my own father worked for Westinghouse in a blue-collar job most of his life. In Westinghouse's home appliance division, not the nuclear division. I remember when Westinghouse was a grand old company, not a bankrupt subsidiary of Toshiba. It was a blue-chip company, so-called, up there with the Pennsylvania Railroad, Polaroid, Chrysler Corporation, International Business Machines, and Transworld Airlines. How the mighty have fallen, eh? What do we have now in place of industrial giants like Westinghouse and the Pennsylvania Railroad? Do you say with pride, well, we're the country that built Snapchat and Disney Studios? Sorry, to me it just isn't the same. But enough of nostalgia. Let's turn from nuclear to coal, and let's start with a song by David Rovix. I haven't been able to track down the news story on which this song is based. A Tennessee citizen attacks a coal mine. Rovix wrote, true story, but I had to make up some of the details since the culprit never got caught. Here we go.
I grew up on this mountain, came back here to dwell. Maybe have a family, plant some corn and dig a well. I was all done with the army, back from Vietnam, where I learned how to hold a rifle and how to set a bomb. I grew up on this mountain, it's in my very soul. So when the company moved next door, started digging for the coal, tearing up the mountain with drillers and drag lines, I knew then what needed to happen to those mines. 10, 9, 8, sometimes that's just how it goes. the ground. Stayed well out of sight. I tied sticks to the equipment, set the timer on, and I knew that in 10 seconds those dozers would be gone. 10, 9, 8. Sometimes that's just how it goes. 3, 2, 1. Get out before it blows. And I figured I did my small part to make the world free. In my humble manner in East Tennessee. 10, 9, 8. Sometimes that's just how it goes. 3, 2, 1. Get out before it blows.
So, some more on coal. The good news here, too. Like nuclear plants, coal-fired plants are closing down, and nothing President Trump can do could halt the rapid decline of this industry either. Here's part of a recent column by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, April 19, 2017. Yes, that Thomas Friedman, that mouthpiece of neoliberal capitalist values. But again, if even the capitalists are turning against coal, that's good news for us all. The piece is titled, Coal Museum Sees Future, Trump Doesn't. Friedman writes, did you catch this gem on CNN.com from April 6? Quote, the Kentucky Coal Mining Museum in Benham, owned by Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College, is switching to solar power to save money. Communications Director Brandon Robinson told CNN affiliate WYMT that the project, quote, will save at least $8,000 to $10,000 off the energy costs of this building alone, unquote. Friedman continues, go figure. The coal mining museum is going solar for solid economic reasons, and President Trump is reviving coal with no economic logic at all. This bizarre contrast speaks to a deeper question of leadership and how we judge presidents. Trump took two major national security decisions in the past week. One was to strike Syria. The other decision you didn't see. It was Trump dismantling budgets and regulations undergirding U.S. climate and environmental protection policies in his nutty effort to revive U.S. coal-fired energy, while quietly announcing plans to withhold a promised $32.5 million U.S. contribution to the UN Population Fund, which supports family planning and maternal health. Unlike the Syria decision, Trump made the second move without seeking a comprehensive briefing from experts. He controls the world's greatest collection of climate scientists at NASA, NOAA, the EPA, the Pentagon, and the CIA. And without ever asking for an intelligence briefing on how the combination of climate change, environmental degradation, drought, and population explosion helped trigger the civil war in Syria, spawn terrorist groups like Boko Haram around Lake Chad, which has lost 90% of its water since 1963, and become the main force pushing tens of thousands of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa into Europe each year and from Central America up to the U.S. Friedman continues, I promise you that Trump will spend the rest of his presidency dealing with the disruptions caused by this cocktail of population explosion and climate environmental degradation, and his generals know it. But in today's politics, bombing is considered presidential, and ignoring science and defunding family planning, when populations are exploding and droughts expanding, these are ho-hum back-page news. The Sierra Club and the Bloomberg Organization formed an environmental joint venture in 2011. They noted that then there were 514 coal-fired power plants in America. And since then, 254 of them have announced that they will shut down. They expect that fully two-thirds of the plants will be phased out by 2022, no matter what Trump says or does. Okay, sidebar comment. Let me reread those figures. In 2011, in the United States, there were 514 coal-fired power plants. Since then, 254 of them have announced they will shut down. Why? Because it's not economically viable, and nothing Trump can do will make them economically viable. Okay, thank you, Thomas Friedman. And that's a voice one doesn't hear often on New World Notes, but in fact, here he's saying something well worth listening to. Let's turn to a voice you've heard more often here, Noam Chomsky. Now, Chomsky nicely ties together all the threads of our show today. Nuclear, coal, destruction of the environment by greenhouse gases, destruction of the environment by nuclear bombs. He spoke in Cambridge, Mass., just this April 24. We'll hear part of his speech today and more of it in some upcoming shows in the near future. We'll start with Amy Goodman asking about a comment Chomsky had made, identifying the most dangerous organization in the history of the world.
The Republican Party, you said, is the most dangerous organization in world history. Can you explain?
I also said that it's an extremely outrageous statement. But the question is whether it's true. I mean, has there ever been an organization in human history that is dedicated with such commitment to the destruction of organized human life on Earth? Not that I'm aware of. Is the Republican organization, I hesitate to call it a party, committed to that? Overwhelmingly. There isn't even any question about it. Take a look at the last primary campaign. Plenty of publicity. A very little comment on the most significant fact. Every single candidate either denied that what is happening is happening, namely serious move towards environmental catastrophe, or there were a couple of moderates, so-called, Jeb Bush, who said, maybe it's happening, we really don't know, but it doesn't matter because fracking is working fine so we can get more fossil fuels. Then there was the guy who was called the adult in the room, John Kasich, the one person who said, yes, it's true, global warming's going on, but it doesn't matter. He's the governor of Ohio. In Ohio, we're going to go on using coal for energy, and we're not going to apologize for it. So that's 100% commitment to racing towards disaster. Then take a look at what's happened since. November 8th was the election. There was, as most of you know, I'm sure, a very important conference underway in Marrakesh, Morocco. Roughly 200 countries at the United Nations-sponsored conference, the goal of which was to put some specific commitments into the verbal agreements that were reached at Paris in December 2015, the preceding international conference on global warming. The Paris conference did intend to reach a verifiable treaty, but they couldn't because of the most dangerous organization in human history. The Republican Congress would not accept any commitments. So therefore, the world was left with verbal promises, but no commitments. Well, last November 8th, they were going to try to carry that forward. On November 8th, in fact, there was a report by the World Meteorological Organization, very dire analysis of the state of the environment and the likely prospects, also pointed out that we're coming perilously close to the tipping point, which was the goal. The goal of the Paris negotiations was to keep things below that, coming very close to it, and other ominous predictions. At that point, the conference pretty much stopped because the news came in about the election. And it turns out that the most powerful country in human history, the richest, most powerful, most influential, the leader of the free world, has just decided not only not to support the efforts, but actively to undermine them. So there's the whole world on one side, literally, at least trying to do something or other. Not enough, maybe, although some places are going pretty far, like Denmark, a couple of others. On the other side, in splendid isolation, is the country led by the most dangerous organization in human history, which is saying, we're not part of this. In fact, we're going to try to undermine it. And we're going to maximize the use of fossil fuels, could carry us past the tipping point. We're not going to provide funding for, as committed in Paris, to developing countries that are trying to do something about the climate problems. We're going to dismantle regulations that retard the devastating impact of production of carbon dioxide and, in fact, other dangerous gases, methane, others. Okay, so the conference kind of pretty much came to a halt. It continued, but the question was, can we salvage something from this wreckage? And pretty amazingly, the countries of the world were looking for salvation to a different country, China. Here we have a world looking for salvation to China, of all places, when the United States is the wrecking machine that's threatening destruction, with all three branches of government in the hands of the most dangerous organization in human history. And I don't have to go through what's happened since, but in general, the cabinet appointments are assigned to people whose commitment and beliefs are that it's necessary to destroy everything in their department that could be of any use to human beings and wouldn't just increase profits and power. And they're doing it very systematically, one after another. EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has been very sharply cut. Actually, the main department that's concerned with environmental issues is the Department of Energy, which also had very sharp cuts, particularly in the environment-related programs. In fact, there's even a ban on posting and publishing information and material about this. And this is not just at the national level. The Republican Party, whatever you want to call it, has been doing this at every level. So in North Carolina, a couple of years ago, where the legislature, mostly thanks to gerrymandering, is in the hands of the Republicans, they called for a study on what sea level rise might be on the North Carolina coast. And there was a serious scientific study which predicted, not a long time, about roughly a meter rise in sea level, which could be devastating to eastern North Carolina. And the legislature did react, namely by passing legislation to ban any actions or even discussion that might have to do with climate change. Actually, the best comment of this, I wish I could quote it verbatim, was by Stephen Colbert, who said, if you have a serious problem, the way to deal with it is to legislate that it doesn't exist. Problem solved, you know. This is going on all over the country. It's not simply climate change. That's bad enough. But there's another huge specter that we're kind of trying to survive under, and that's nuclear war. That's a whole other story. Here, both the Obama administration and increasingly Trump are radically increasing that danger. The threat of the new developments is captured very effectively in the best simple monitor of the state of the world established at the beginning of the nuclear age by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. I'm sure you all know about this, but the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists regularly brings together a group of scientists, political analysts, others, very serious people, to try to give some kind of estimate of what the situation of the world is. The question is, how close are we to termination of the species? And they have a clock, the doomsday clock. When it hits midnight, we're finished. End of the human species and much else. And the question every year is, how far is the minute hand from midnight? Well, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2014, the bulletin began to take that into account and moved the minute hand up to 3 minutes to midnight, where it remained last year. About a week into Trump's term, the clock was moved again to 2.5 minutes to midnight. That's the closest it's been since 1953, and that means extermination of the species is very much an open question. I don't want to say it's solely the impact of the Republican Party. Obviously, that's false. But they certainly are in the lead in openly advocating and working for destruction of the human species. I agree, that's a very outrageous statement. So I therefore simply suggest that you take a look at the facts and see if it has any merit. In my view, the facts are pretty clear.
And here we must pause. Again, we'll hear more of Chomsky's Cambridge speech soon. Many thanks to Boston Independent Media Guy Chuck Rosina for recording Chomsky's talk and making that recording available to us. And of course, thank you for listening to New World Notes. If you like, you can listen again at our website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust saying, illegitimi non carborundum. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. And please tune in again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites.
just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear part two of former CIA agent and whistleblower Kevin Shipp. The first part was aired a few weeks ago and can be accessed at the website radioforall.net. Once on the site, search under my name, Cheryl with a C. This second part of the speech you're about to hear was given in the fall of 2016 in Northern California. Kevin Shipp frequently refers to Dane in the speech, and by this he's referring to Dane Wigington of geoengineeringwatch.org, who has been very outspoken about chemtrails and climate engineering. Kevin Shipp recently published a book called In the Company of Shadows. And here he is, former CIA agent and whistleblower Kevin Shipp, sharing his inside knowledge from working at the CIA.
There are certain major newspapers, of which if I mentioned their name, you would know them. These are national papers that are communicating and directly connected, in this case, to the CIA and in some cases to the NSA. So if a whistleblower decides, I'm freedom of the press, man, I'm going to the press and I'm going to report to the press this illegal stuff that I've seen. So they call up XYZ national newspaper. And if you do enough checking, you'll find out who that is. I want to tell you my story. I want to tell you what I've seen. In this case, the reporter got right on the phone, contacted the CIA and told them what this person had just reported for the story. That has been done several times with this paper. They communicate with the CIA regularly regarding what they're going to publish and what they're not going to publish. Chilling. I call this massive structure the shadow government. Another fellow calls it the deep state. Take your pick. But I want to show you how massive this secret government is. Now, this is since 9/11. I can tell you a lot of this was pre-existing 9/11. Most people think that the NSA surveillance program was a result of 9/11. Isn't that what you've been told? The NSA surveillance program existed before 9/11 happened. That's what they're not telling you. 1,271 government organizations involved in secrecy within the United States. 1,931 private companies, large private companies, involved in secrecy in the United States, bound by the secrecy agreement. 10,000 intelligence locations across the United States. Did you get that? 10,000 secret locations, not overseas, not in China, not in Indonesia, inside the United States. Now, the CIA legally is only supposed to have a foreign charter. Anybody know that? It was forbidden from having any operations within the United States. That was its restraint. That restraint is now gone. 10,000 locations. 4.8 million Americans, and that's just the ones we know of, hold government security clearances and are bound by and threatened by the secrecy agreement to stay silent. Now, the figure's a lot bigger than that, but that's a lot of people and their families and everybody that they're connected to. Do you think they're going to speak up if it means total destruction? Probably not. 854,000 people hold top secret security clearances, which has severe penalties, and there's compartments above that, some of which I had, that have even stricter penalties. But that is the number of people that have top secret security clearances where they've got the keys to the kingdom, essentially. Each one of these agencies employs the secrecy agreement as a binding tool. Now, it used to be to protect legitimate classified information. It has morphed into a threatening tool to silence dissent. Of course, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the Department of State, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, Department of State, and now we know that NOAA and the National Weather Service are binding their employees with secrecy agreements. Why is the weather so secret? You got to ask that, don't you? Maybe Dane's right? Why do they have to bind people like that? I am a huge proponent of the truth, and I am really, really against secrecy in a constitutional government unless it's absolutely necessary. Why would the National Weather Service make a weather program secret and make people sign a non-disclosure form? You got to ask that question. The military-industrial complex, tens of thousands of government contractors. The government comes, for example, most people don't know this, the CIA has a technical firm it's created called InQtel. InQtel offered, I think it was a $5 million contract to Google. Now, what they do is they come to these companies and they say, hey, we'll give you a contract for $5 million, $20 million. And most companies are thirsty, and they're out trying to get contracts to survive. So they'll say, oh, but we'll take, yeah, we'll take the contract. Google took the contract, $5 million contract. They are now joined with the CIA in Qtel. What are they doing? They're doing research on trends on the Internet and Facebook. They're monitoring the Internet is what they're doing. Let me just break that down for you. Now, do you think any of the Google executives can talk about the program? Do you think maybe they made them sign an agreement before they got the $5 million? Yeah. Why don't you hear anything about that? Why isn't Google saying anything about that? Well, that's why. Employees at every level. If you've got big-time Beltway Bandit government contractor X that gets a covert agency contract, they are bound to sign the secrecy agreement, and every employee at every level on that contract has to sign the agreement. Secretaries, logistics people, of course, the CEOs, people that run the copy machines, all bound by the secrecy agreement. Thousands and thousands of people. You see the number of people that are bound by the government out there? Are you kind of getting that picture? It's a lot. And that's just the ones that we know of. Here's a good quote. The top secret world of government created in response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 has become so large, so unwieldy, and so secretive that no one knows how much money it costs, how many people it employs, how many programs exist within it, or exactly how many agencies do the same work. And then I italicize the next one. Not even Congress knows the size and the extent of this intelligence secret apparatus. That's why I call it the shadow government. They don't even know how big it is. They don't even know a lot of things that the CIA, especially, and others are even engaged in overseas. Syria is a prime example. This is a separate secret government that operates, and this is the part that really gets to me, it operates outside the Constitution. We are now in a post-constitutional government. It's over. As far as the Constitution goes, that's why I'm here. Some of us want to bring that back. And the only way to do it is to stand up against this. And there's risk involved, but we have to do it. Because if we don't, we're going down. Have we created a monster? My gosh. If you knew the size and extent, it's, yes, we have. It's shocking. Now, Dane played this, and I want to emphasize this, because this is more than a smoking gun. When the director of the CIA comes out, anybody know anything about the Council on Foreign Relations? Uh-huh. So you know who he's talking to, don't you? All right. A little global action going on here. All right. But when the director of the CIA comes out and makes a speech, every word is refined, winnowed down, and everything he says means something. Everything. Listen to what he says. Another example is the array of technologies often referred to collectively as geoengineering. Kudos to Dane. They're coming out and they're saying it. That potentially could help reverse the warming effects of global climate change, one that has gained my personal attention. Geoengineering has gained the personal attention of the director of the CIA. That means something. Is stratospheric aerosol injection, or SAI? Now, let me tell you, based on my humble and meek experience, when the CIA comes out and admits something like this, they've been doing it for at least 20 years. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it's about to be exposed. Or he wouldn't be saying this. This is beyond a smoking gun. Now, some people will say, you just got that off a conspiracy internet website. I mean, come on. Well, you know where I got this from? CIA.gov, the CIA's own website. They're putting it out there on their website in writing. Now, why would they do that? Unless it's the two things I just talked about. They've been doing it for a while, then the cat's about to come out of the bag. The vax people are going to do such a much better job in this. But I just wanted to mention, because I hate cover-ups, because I lived one, personally. And that's what's happening with the vaccine-autism connection in a big way. Covering up the truth at the expense of young children and their health and the families that are ruined because of this. So you want to know the connection between autism and vaccines? You know who the first people to ask are? The parents. The ones who saw their child's behavior before the vaccine and what happened after the vaccine. One of the doctors on Vax said that real medicine is an art where you listen to the patient and you watch. So that is the absolute, that was a wonderful statement. Only a parent knows what their child was like before that vaccine and what their child was like after the vaccine. And if the doctor was honest and not connected to big pharma and money, he would listen to that parent. And if the CDC really was open to a true investigation, they would conduct studies to find out how this was happening, number one, and number two, how they can possibly treat these children, wouldn't they? Why are they not? Billions of dollars, let's just start with that. Nature of government, that also. There are independent doctors, I know one myself, Big fan of his, has a whole page on autism, brilliantly written. So there are doctors out there that are talking about this stuff. I want to give kudos to the courageous lawyers that are standing up for this stuff. You guys and ladies are in here. Hats off to you, man. That's raw courage. That's the kind of courage we need. And I'm telling you, if there's attorneys watching this, your country is at stake. Your freedom is at stake. This is the final hour. We are coming down to the perfect storm. Put your reputation down and come out and stand with these people and have the guts and the courage to support your Constitution. Because if you don't, we've got maybe half a decade at most before this comes down. So thank you to the attorneys. That is true courage. The vax people will talk about this. The CDC insider that is going to be talking about some of these things. There are some people still out there that have courage. That's what we need today, is that kind of courage. The age of cowardice in the United States, and being caught up in your pension and being caught up in how much you make and your next promotion and your granite countertops and all of that, those days are gone. We're on the precipice of big danger environmentally and economically. The dollar will collapse. It will collapse eventually. The IMF just recognized the Chinese yuan as a reserve currency. The Chinese has been buying gold to back that up. We owe them $1.5 trillion. They can't call that debt because we can't pay it. What they can do is make the yuan the reserve currency. When that happens, the United States economy collapses and the dollar is no longer of any value. Okay, so what do you do? I saw this happen to me personally. My wife and especially my oldest son were almost terminal. They covered it up. They told me I could never say I work for the CIA. They told them they could never tell anybody about their case because of the state secrets privilege. What do you do in a case like that? Well, there's only one thing to do. You write an expose. So I wrote from the company of shadows. Not for self-glorification, trust me. There was none of it in that. It was one heck of a battle. When the book was written, this is one of the excerpts from the book, one of the pages of many. There is nothing classified in this excerpt at all. Nothing. It's talking about Blackout began receiving threatening letters accusing them of security violations and commanding them not to exchange correspondence with our family. It's just a system that they use of intimidation is what it's talking about, and they blacked it out. Now, based on an executive order issued by President Ronald Reagan, for the CIA to black information out because of negligence or because of it's embarrassing is illegal. It's criminal to do that. Violation of the Constitution, supreme law of the land. Well, they did. So, here's another excerpt from the book. Now, this talks about what they do to the families. They take away their names. They give them fake names like the Doe family. There's fake names here that are blacked out. They're not even their real names. They're fake names, but they black them out. Instead, I want you to know that they use fake names to cover the identities of innocent mothers and children who have been exposed to serious toxins in a secret government program. This picture that I put in the book has a lot of meaning. I'll explain that to you in a moment. Down at the bottom, Blackout's identities are, and case facts are hidden in secret. That's not even their name behind that blackout. It's a general term. They didn't want anybody to know that they do this to civilians. Real important. So what did I do? I call this in chapter 25, the tyranny of secrecy. We have a tyrannical government that is now functioning with a huge abuse of secrecy and silencing anybody that will stand against it by classifying everything. This photograph here, when I wrote the book and they blacked these things out, I had a decision to make. What am I going to do about this? I swore an oath to the Constitution. Who's going to win, government intimidation or the Constitution? Well, it's a painful choice, but it's kind of an easy one. So I built a code into the book. I referred to it as a shadow code, and there are things in it like this. This shadow is the actual shadow of the young man that almost died from this toxic exposure. They didn't know whose shadow that was. They do now. Down here, it says, my family was devastated by our government's abuse of blackout. They don't want you to know how they tried to silence me. They blacked it out. Although it's out there in the public and other places. There's studies this thick written on that. So I built a code into the book. It's a numerical code, and it weaves through there. And if you follow the numerical sequence, it opens up what these blackouts actually say and what they use to try to silence our family. Okay? I learned one thing. If you play by their rules, they will destroy you. If you realize that freedom is only in the truth and you come out full bore and just lay it out there, that's probably why I'm still alive today. You go out on the internet and you see things like, I'm surprised this guy's not in a dumpster. Well, I'm still alive because I came out. I have this thing called the Constitution and freedom of speech. I came out full bore and made this stuff public. If you fear them, they have you. That's how they do it. They manipulate the American people through intimidation and fear. Do not fear. If you don't fear the government, you're truly free. So, as I wrap this up, This is a time for courage. As I mentioned, the age of cowardice in the United States or being too busy trying to survive, those days are gone. The environment is collapsing. Our economy is on the verge of collapse. The federal government has programs in place that when the economy does collapse, to take care of civil unrest in a very extreme fashion. Some of you know about that. It's a very serious time. It's a time for courage. It's a time for truth. Secret activity, especially illegal secret activity, is like scorpions and cockroaches. You turn the light on and they can't handle it, man. They scramble for the nearest bookshelf or what, right? So it is with government. The founding fathers wrote document after document after document saying the Constitution was created to protect the people from the tyranny of government because government will go evil every time. That's its nature. The Bill of Rights was not written to govern the people. It was written to protect the people from the tyranny of government. That's the whole reason it was written. Courageous people like Dane, Geoengineering Watch. Does that look like a normal sky to you? God bless Dane for what he's doing. You know, he is doing this out of character, really. Raw courage and character at personal sacrifice. And I'll have to tell you, Dane is the one that got me to come back in from the wilderness, from off the grid, because I had seen this go up to such high levels, and I know some of the penetrations in the media. I had just had it. So I went off building my little off-the-grid farm and put up our solar panels, and I think Dane worked me over for a couple of months. And finally, I said, you know, this guy's really a man of integrity, and I'll do it. And that's why I'm here, honestly. It's because of Dane. So I thank you, Dane. I appreciate that. My wife and I have to sit on our beautiful off-the-grid farm, get up in the morning, and we have to see this sky over Vidalia, Georgia. What used to be a beautiful blue sky, we have to sit there and watch this on a Monday, 94 degrees centigrade, 9 o'clock in the morning. Tuesday morning, it's not there. All those trails are gone. There's an ongoing joke I have with my wife. I'll lean to Sue and I'll say, man, it looks like they canceled all the traffic, air traffic over Georgia. There's no condensation anywhere. You see what a joke that is? One day, the laws of physics are one way, and the next day, all the laws of physics change. One day, there's trails. The next day, they canceled all the flights over Georgia. come on. How ridiculous can it get? But it ruins our skyline. You know, I left, went off the grid, out in the wilderness, to get away from government tyranny and all the ugliness I've seen, and now I have to sit on my front porch and see them do it again in the sky. We have got to bring the truth in about autism. There are kids suffering. It is now, by all scientists read, it is an epidemic, exponential epidemic. This is so serious. We've got to stop accepting the intimidation, the career destruction, the attacks on reputation, and I've got to give the vax people, I love people that have the guts and the courage to take the heat that the establishment is throwing at them and keep going anyway. Call me what you want, pal. I'm going to keep going, and nothing's going to stop me. That's what they're doing. And you don't know how refreshing it is for me to see that, having kind of been alone for several years in this. All right. We have got to stop government's tyrannical overreach of our entire lives. They've been following, bugging, and eavesdropping on every single thing that we do for way too long. They've been scaring us and intimidating us into not rocking the boat for way too long. I like to put it this way. You got a neighbor who comes to you and says, hey, two guys from the Lions Club were knocked on my door. They're asking questions about you. Okay, no big deal. What if that neighbor comes to you and says, hey, man, two guys from the CIA knocked on my door and they're asking questions about you. How are you going to feel? What are you going to feel? Fear. That's their weapon. Another analogy I like to use is these agencies, the CIA and others, are like the Wizard of Oz. Remember that movie? The big, I'm big, powerful Oz. Lightning bolt shooting at us, you will not mess with me or you will be destroyed. And then the dog pulls the curtain away and there's this little tiny guy in there working the levers. That's our government. They want us to be scared of them with this big mean face, but they're a bunch of little tiny bureaucrats pulling levers trying to make you afraid of them, and that's how they do it. What do we have? What do we need to bring back is this. We the people are supposed to run our government, not the other way around. They are supposed to work for us. Not us for them. And the only thing that's going to change this is courage. People like many of you out there, they're standing up and saying, enough is enough, not anymore, not my country, you don't, not my constitution, you don't. I want to leave you with one final thought. Please remember this, because this is what it all comes down to. I learned this personally. As long as I feared them covering up this case, not only were they winning, they were breaking into my house, they were drugging my dog, they were painting chemicals on the ceiling. But once I decided I'm not going to be afraid of you anymore, I'm coming out full bore, and I'm coming out against you full bore all the way, that's when things started to work on our side. And that's when we started to win, and that's how we got the book out. When I made that decision, I will not fear you, the last thing I told them was this, and then I'll put this quote up. Last thing I said to them, I said, the same courage that made me a good CIA officer here with you is the same courage that is enabling me to stand up against you now. And that's the last thing I told them before I walked out the door. And they know it. So I want you to remember this as I close. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, when they fear you, there's liberty. And that's what it's all about. Thank you very much.
You were just listening to the second part of a speech given by CIA whistleblower Kevin Shipp, whose book is called From the Company of Shadows. And now we'll hear a short clip by author Doug Valentine, whose latest book is called The CIA as Organized Crime. This clip comes from a recent interview by Sean Stone and was aired on RT.
The CIA is not a social services organization. It's not a law enforcement organization. It works on behalf of the major corporations and the establishments in the United States, which historically are equated with the state being the financial institutions, industry that provides jobs for many Americans, all the different industries that are taken together. These are the industries in the United States. It's financial institutions are felt to be the segment of the United States that has the greatest stake in the United States, that invests the most of its own money into the United States, and thus, when it's called the establishment, rules the United States through its own secret agreements. And it does so not in support of average Americans. Its goal is not to make sure that there's universal health care or that everybody has a doctor or gets medical need, as is in the case of many other nations. Its single purpose is to serve the interests of these major industrialists who compose the establishment in the United States. And then at the very highest levels, the people in these industries work hand in hand with the senior executive management in the CIA, and they work together towards mutual ends. And this is the essence of American imperialism, is that it's always advancing the economic interests of the United States abroad. Its goal is to pave the way for American corporations to gain a foothold or expand their influence overseas.
And we'll end the show today with another clip from a Sean Stone interview, this time with Sonoma University professor Peter Phillips, also of Project Censored, discussing the media and propaganda in America.
Well, the corporate media is in the entertainment business. They're not in the news business. So they're looking for stories that are going to be something that will be stimulating or building people's curiosity and something that has an emotional content. People died, bombs went off, that sort of thing. So most of the stories in corporate media today are coming from what we call public relations and propaganda firms. So they are prepackaged. So if we look at the news, whether it's a newspaper or in corporate media, 80% of all the news stories are being funneled through a public relations propaganda firm, either government or a private firm. And that's the study that we worked on.
Here he's asked what companies are involved in using these PR firms and propaganda.
All the big corporations in the world, the corporate 500, the corporate 1000, any product you see in a supermarket like Safeway has a public relations company that's marketing for them. There's really any difference between public relations advertising and propaganda. You're making an attempt to persuade people to think a certain way, buy something, or support a political position in some capacity. So these companies do both. They work for government, they work for private corporations, they work for nonprofits, and they're worldwide. So the largest ones are WPP, Omnicom, and Interpublic Group. And these are massive corporations, $35 billion a year in sales.
And next he's asked about the connection between the corporate media and the military-industrial complex.
Well, the corporate media is continually working with the military-industrial complex in the sense that we actually say the military-industrial media complex because they're so interlocked. And the Pentagon will release listings of these 100 ex-generals or ex-admirals are approved for use by corporate media or recommended. And when they recommend, that's who gets on the air. There's a relationship between continuing to convince the American public that the military is there to support and protect them versus the real fact that the U.S. empire, military empire, 700 bases worldwide, and NATO together are really about protecting centralized capital in the world. That's the transnational capitalist class, the 0.001% of the people who control $100 trillion worth of wealth. They want to be able to invest that wealth anywhere in the world and have no interference from other governments. So that's what the military empire is about, is protecting their capital. It's not about protecting us. But the media is there to convince us that they're there to save us from terrorism and other threats.
And here he's asked about Operation Mockingbird.
Well, after the church committees and the revelation that Operation Mockingbird was a program the CIA was running across the country, and they had thousands of journalists that they were paying to do stories, they're no longer allowed to pay American journalists. They can still pay foreign journalists. But we believe that there's still some very tight relationships between being a journalist in cahoots, so to speak, with a central intelligence agency. So you get special stories, you get insight, you have access, and as far as we know, probably there's still some money being exchanged.
And here he's asked about the propaganda that was used in the lead-up to the first Gulf War.
Well, that was the story of Nayira, who went before Congress with tears in her eyes, said they dumped the babies out of the incubators and stole the incubators and took them back to Baghdad. It was essentially not true. Helen Knowlton, the public relations firm that now works for WPP, choreographed the whole thing with cooperation from the White House. So these were deliberate lies. So that was deliberately a fake news. Then we called it disinformation. Disinformation essentially means the same thing. It's a deliberate lie. And misinformation can be something that's a mistake. You may or may not know it's deliberate. But in this case, it was for Nayira and that story, it was clearly a deliberate lie. Sometimes we simply don't know. And in terms of President Trump saying that Syria used nerve gas on their own people, we don't know that to be true. There's no evidence other than there was a bombing raid, but that plane delivered sarin gas. There's no evidence of that. So if anything, that's misinformation. In corporate media in the U.S., for a while, when they first started, when that first happened, they're saying alleged attack of sarin gas. And then it very quickly became, within a couple of days, almost factual that Assad had used sarin gas on his own people. The rest of the world and media, corporate media, sees it differently and that it's still to be determined. When it comes to corporate media, and if you don't have independent sources, you're getting mostly propaganda. You're getting a very straightforward State Department, Pentagon approach to how they see the world and without a critical eye or view from other sources. So that makes stations like RT, Telesur, and other sources of independent news, Global Research, Truthout, very important for the American public to have access to other points of view and other stories. Now, they've been trying to call that fake news or propaganda news from the other side, and that's simply wrong. I think that's where the term fake news has emerged. It's just trying to discredit, like WikiLeaks and some of these other organizations that are releasing factual information and doing a really good job of telling us what's going on, and they want to try to convince the American public that, well, that's fake, and if you can only listen to MSNBC or Fox, and that'll tell you the real truth. Disinformation, misinformation, biased news happens daily from a variety of sources. The public relations firms are hired to present a spin or an image of what's happened. There's 3,000 PR people that work in government, and they do press releases constantly. So they're trying to put the best light on their employer. And that's just a natural process that we have to sort through and figure out and be able to objectify academically. And at universities, we do this to be able to look at it and say, well, wait a minute, there's more to this story. There's other aspects of that. And that's what our research program, Project Sensitive, is doing now for 40 years.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Spectrum Time Warner cable workers without a contract since 2013 say enough is enough and strike.
But first, building trades activists from electrical workers IBEW Local 569 knew they had to do something. We couldn't let him come and speak to us and just sit there, said William Stedham, an executive board member of the local. If we hadn't, everyone would think that the building trades was on board with him 100%, and we're not. So a few minutes into his speech, the workers stood up with signs that said, "Resist," and turned their backs on the billionaire in chief, Trump.
The gesture flew in the face of a directive from building trade leadership that attendees should be on their best behavior. Demonstrators include the political director and business manager of the local, as well as the president and political director of the San Diego Building Trades. Interestingly, the media present failed to cover the protesters, or when the security snatched their signs and yanked them out of the room, but rather projected to the public what seemed to be unanimous support for Trump.
But that was not the case. And to find out why the activists were furious, Gretchen Newsom, political director of IBEW Local 569, San Diego, joins us. Gretchen Newsom, set the stage further for us. What happened at that moment? Because I was watching TV. I was watching TV, and I was told that everybody was unanimous in their applause and consensus of the speech and receptive to what Mr. Trump had to say to the building trades members. What really happened?
Well, I think that would be one of his famous alternative facts. definitely some falsehood to that statement. You know, right from the onset of when he came out onto the stage, the applause was pretty tepid in what you would expect to how one would be received as a president of the United States of America. There were many people that just had their cameras in the air to capture the footage of it, but were not applauding. And to kind of provide you a little bit of color as to what happened, the president comes onto the stage, he starts his remarks. My delegation and myself are seated. We don't like some of the policies that are coming out of his office right now and some of the statements, of course. So he starts calling out in kind of like a typical rock star fashion of like, hey, where's my iron workers? Where's my plumbers and my pipe fitters to try to engender some additional applause? And it remains pretty tepid. And then he has the audacity to call out the electricians, IBEW. And it's almost like crickets in that room when he's doing that. And so he calls them out again, and he calls out the ones from New York, which are very progressive. And when they don't applaud wildly, he kind of slights them and says, oh, well, you make too much. You don't even have to stand up. And it's at that moment that my delegation and myself from San Diego chose to stand up with our hashtag resist signs and turn our backs on the president and face the media and face all of our brothers and sisters to say that we resist his alternative facts. We resist his misogyny. We resist his policies that are anti-worker and some of the actions that he's been doing. So that moment happened. We were then, after many minutes and many people surrounding us, trying to oust us, were removed from the conference. And then later on in the conference, but I think it was, you know, part of our action that somewhat enabled people to listen a little bit more closely and resist the alternative facts, if they're not facts. And he clearly did not have support from most of the people in that room. It's just, frankly, not the case. I cannot think of a single building trades local union that endorsed his candidacy during the presidential race. The national building trades had endorsed Hillary Clinton. But, you know, there are many people in that room that wanted to listen to the president, so we made our stand, our silent protest. And that's what happened.
McGreevy, who's the head of the Building Trades Council, and a lot of the international presidents do seem to think that they can work with Trump, despite all of his anti-labor policies. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about some of the things that Trump wants to do, and tell us why you think that McGreevy thinks he can work with Trump.
Well, you know, I think some of it is a little bit of fear-based with this presidency. And you heard it in the clip that you played. As soon as people start to dispute his version of the truth and say, no, we were not that supportive, he immediately flies to a threat to workers and to the trades members of saying, well, if you dare to question me and my belief and what I think happened, then you can expect far fewer jobs. So there's almost like this internal pivot of the stomach of like, wow, I'm fearful that he's going to take away my jobs if I go against him. So there are some in that room that feel it's in their best interest to go alongside him and with him. But us at IBW Local 569 in San Diego, we've already identified a whole host of different actions that he's taken where we don't just judge a president by his words and his false promises, where he's saying, I promise you jobs, but then at the same time that he's doing that, he's going and appointing people to power in his administration that are very anti-union and anti-worker, whether it's people that don't believe in prevailing wages, which are good wages for workers that provide a baseline of wages for a certain skill set that they have earned, or whether it does not have support so far for project labor agreements, which is also how you hire locally, create local jobs, and invest back in the community with tax dollars. So, and I mean, if you listen to his entire speech and remarks before the building trades unions and their workers, he doesn't once mention the word union, and that's really striking. And he also fails to address any of the host of very important policy topics that are our bread and butter, whether it's the good-paying union jobs or the prevailing wages I already spoke about, or Davis-Bacon, or workplace safety, or meaningful investments in infrastructure with an actual plan that's not just a corporate giveaway. So he's failing in all those aspects to talk to us about that, and that's what our expectation was. So if you look at his false promises, his heavy reliance on just rhetoric that sounds good but isn't based in reality, and then his actions, and that's where you judge a person is by their actions, and his appointment of different people to power that are anti-union, our local in San Diego has already identified, you know, he's not a president that's going to be for the people and for the workers. He's for the corporate big guys, the Wall Street guys, the guys with all the money, and that's not who we represent.
Gretchen Newsom also talked about, which I understand your local was particularly perturbed about, those appointments that Trump made that are really virulently anti-labor. In fact, some of them are notoriously anti-labor and have written about anti-labor policies consistently. Tell us about that as well, which helps spur forward and provoke the protest of Trump when he spoke at the Building Trades Conference.
Sure. So, I mean, we start getting a little bit into the weeds on some of the policy topics, which I wish I had a full hour to dedicate to and discussing.
Get into the weeds. Go ahead. Let's drain the swamp. Yes.
Shall we? That would be actually great if he lived up to that. But instead, he's appointing a former lobbyist of the ABC, the Association of Builders and Contractors, to help run the Department of Labor. And the ABC has been pretty steadfast in their belief that union construction workers are paid too much and shouldn't be paid what we're paid, that they're constantly advocating for reducing wages, which we take great offense to, because, I mean, that's dipping into your pocketbook of how you're going to feed your family and support them. They've also been, their wording for how they describe it is that regulations are onerous. Let's get rid of them. The regulations that they're talking about are workplace safety regulations. You know, where we believe that our workers that go out onto a construction job, there needs to be a baseline of safety for them, that they're not putting their lives at risk in order to build a building needlessly. So that's Mr. Jeffrey Burr of the ABC that he's put into a position of power. And then there's another individual who is his labor advisor from out of the Heritage Foundation. It's a very conservative foundation, named James Shirk, who has been, throughout his career, he's a policy wonk, been attacking minimum wage increases or wage increases in general, has also previously stated that project labor agreements, again, how we get our work and invest back in the local community, should be illegal, has been supportive of the right to work, and I always say for less, policy initiative across the nation. So these are the people that he has placed in power, and this is their kind of ideology that just runs smack against everything that we stand for, which is good wages for our workers so they can support their families and their communities, a safe workplace so so that they're not having accidents or deaths on the job site, and then also the ability to retire with dignity. So if he's placing into power these people that oppose the very nations of what we're, or notions of what we're fighting for, we can't support him on that.
Gretchen, there's also something called solidarity, which the union movement was based upon and founded on. And
yes,
if Trump were to deliver something to the construction unions, is there a feeling in your local that the fact that he's eviscerating and attacking unions throughout the country and other groups also, that you still have to oppose him?
My local will still oppose him on that. We are lockstep in our partnerships with different community organizations and the environmental movement. Just to touch upon the environmental movement, for our members of IBW 569 of San Diego and Imperial Counties, a lot of our work is derived from solar jobs or wind or geothermal, the renewable energy jobs, and we're really investing heavily in green-collar jobs. And so when you have a president that denies climate change and is actively trying to dismantle the EPA, we're going to continue to take offense to that. So even if he came forward, he's supposed to be making an announcement any day now about prevailing wages and Davis-Bacon. We don't know what that is. You would have expected him to make that announcement before the building trades when he addressed us, but he didn't. You know, we'll see what's going to happen.
So, just talk. I mean,
we're going to be lockstep in solidarity.
Gretchen, not everybody knows what Davis-Bacon is. Could you just talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So it sets a baseline for wages so that you don't have this spiral to the bottom to pay the workers as least the least amount as possible, which therefore, in our minds, is a detriment to the community of what you're building because you're going to have faulty buildings. But Davis-Bacon provides prevailing wages, a baseline of good wages, to a skilled and trained workforce on federal projects.
And the expectation of what Trump might do?
Well, I mean, I would certainly hope if he continues to say the things that he says about how he is a president and a builder, isn't it great to have a builder, that he would be supportive of Davis-Bacon. But until that actually happens, I'm just going to base him on his actions and his other false rhetoric. And so far, I'm not impressed. I don't believe that he represents workers or working class America.
Let me also ask you how prevalent IBEW Local 569 is in the building trade, since we have generally been given the impression, certainly by media, that there's a unanimity of support for Trump, that there is complete antagonism to the issues such as the XL pipeline. It should go forward. It's going to provide jobs. The Dakota Access Pipeline should be built, should be completed. It's going to provide jobs. Are you just a ray of sunshine and hope in the building trades wilderness?
Well, IBW 569, and under the leadership of our business manager, Nick Segura, we are residing in progressive California. We have a very progressive outlook on the need to invest in renewable energy and to address climate change through climate action. So in that vein, I mean, that's where we're making big investments with our apprenticeship program and how we're actively investing in that field. But, you know, there are we recognize also that there are other locals throughout the nation that are very still dependent on fossil fuels. And as much as we believe and are taking action to release ourselves of a reliance on fossil fuels and put ourselves more on reliance on renewable energy, there are still other locals that aren't there yet.
You going to be participating in any May Day activities?
Absolutely. We participate in most nearly every rally. So the tax march was just this last weekend. Many of us were participating in the Women's March, and then we've got also on the book the Climate March. So we are fully engaged, out in number, and taking action to make sure that the presidency, the nation, and our local entities are actually investing in working families and helping to support our communities.
And we've been speaking with the furious, we're not going to take it anymore, Gretchen Newsom, political director of IBEW Local 569 San Diego, and they're not going to take it anymore, and neither are we. We want, hey, workers' rights, our human rights, and we want it all. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thousands of striking Spectrum Time Warner cable workers took to the streets for a mass rally after walking a picket line for the past week. Fed up with being without a contract since 2013, the strikers service Spectrum Time Warner cable field equipment, keeping customers' internet and cable service up and running. The workers on strike range from warehouse and service technicians to the members of the engineering department.
Yes, we have bills to pay, but more importantly, we have families that need health care, retirement that needs to be robust, and morale that needs to be positive, says one of the striking IBEW union workers. The 1,700 technicians walked off the job March 28th after years of trying to get a contract and failing.
The union said Spectrum Time Warner Cable wants to cut employer contributions to pensions and other benefits. So let's head to the rally.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you local union number 3, IBEW, business manager Mr. Christopher Erickson.
Spectrum Charter Communications, welcome to New York! Support our fight for a fair contract. Yeah. CEO paid $99 million. Ooh. Disgrace, union busting, corporate greed, perfect together. We know union jobs are good jobs. That's what we're fighting for. We need this city to support our fight for a fair contract and to support collective bargaining. Yeah. It is our right to be on strike, to fight for the benefits that you have and you deserve and are not willing to give up. You are not alone. New York City is a union town. Yeah! They have woken a sleeping giant. Yeah! And we're all in. Come on up. I want to introduce Vinny Alvarez. He's a member of Local 3. He's the president of the New York City Central Labor Council. Vinny Alvarez.
Yeah! Let me hear you.
This is a struggle for all New Yorkers, and it's a struggle for all working people. Our message is real clear. We in the New York City labor movement, we're 1.3 million strong. We represent workers from every industry, and we will stand with you in this fight. We will stand with you as long as it takes to get a fair contract, which you deserve. You deserve fairness at the bargaining table. Is it fair? Is it fair that while Charter Spectrum makes millions and millions of dollars, their CEOs, and is so extraordinarily profitable, is it fair that they want to put you and your members and your families in the third-rate medical plan? Is it fair that they want to say to hell with retirement security and cut the pensions that have protected you and your families for years? Is that fair?
No!
Will you let them stand for it?
No!
So our message is clear. You're going to hear from a lot of people today. We have great elected officials around the city that are here supporting you. We have a lot of other unions that are around here supporting you. You have terrific leadership and Chris Erickson and the leadership of Local 3 that is going to stand with you in this fight. But they need to know New York is
and always will remain a strong union town. We will stand with you to make sure you and your families are protected, are supported during the strike, and we will always, always do the right thing for all working people in the city. You are not alone. We will be out here with you as long as it takes to get a fair contract. Stay together. Stay strong. And never, ever, ever give up. Never give up, brother.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Benny. Brothers and sisters, my sister, our friend, the public advocate of the city of New York who has your back, Tish James.
What do we want? A contract. What do we want?
No!
What do we want?
Contract.
What do we want?
Contract.
What do we want?
Contract.
And why do we want it?
No!
This is a teaching moment. And it's a teaching moment to Spectrum. Because they have made record number of profits, and their CEO makes $99 million, so they're not hurting at all. And all that we want is a fair contract. Let them know that you, when you come to the city, you will respect union, period.
Clear, as the city's chief financial officer,
as somebody who has a vote on the Franchise Concession Review Committee of the City of New York. We did not give you a franchise so you could exploit the workers of this city. We did not give you this privilege to do business in the city so you could hurt the families of working people in this town. We thought very clearly that you understood that this city is a union town. And I want Spectrum to know that it is time to recognize that proposing to cut benefits, proposing to make it impossible for people to pay the bills and the rent, is just not going to go down in our town. I stand with you. We will march with you. We will fight for you. We will be part of the struggle. And at the end of the day, when you turn on your TV or you get on the internet, it's because you were union and you were New York City. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. They can't fix this system without you. This is your system. This ain't their system. You did this. You built this city. For a company that's supposed to be so smart, you would think they understand that you can't do your job when they give you faulty equipment to install in their name and then blame you for that equipment failures. You have a right to fight to tell them that's not our fault. That is part of this picture here. And unfortunately, the customers have been hung out to dry here by this company. You've got the corporate greed that the CEO of this company has. This is just about money. You think if he made $100 million, he probably thought he'd be too greedy. So he only took 99. A disgrace. We're the 99%. We want fair wages. We want a fair contract. Now, thank you, brothers and sisters. Hang in there. United, we win. We win.
Local 3. Local 3. Local 3. Local 3. Local 3. Local 3.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
They tied wires to my hands and put metal clippers on my ears to electrocute me. They wanted to get names of my gay friends.
If you don't have proof, then I'm not guilty.
There's quite a few gargoyles in the gang. You know, people are nuts. We celebrate that. If anything, it makes it more rounded.
And we're all fragile, genuine people underneath with emotions, and we're a hot mess of real life. We're real people. The whole point is getting on stage, performing. Your vulnerabilities at home, you deal with that when you go home.
We're just showing people the London side of drag.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Refugee voices describe anti-gay terror in Chechnya, homophobic crackdowns resume in Nigeria and Iran, but London dragsters find high drama in high heels dressed as a girl. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 22nd, 2017. The week has brought mostly bad news for LGBTQ people and those who support them. 53 young men were arrested in Nigeria on April 15th at a motel in the northern city of Zaria. Prosecutor Munir Nasir told a court on April 19th that the defendants were illegally celebrating the marriage of a gay couple. The BBC reported that their defense lawyer says the young men, most of them students, were arrested at a birthday party, not a wedding. Each has pleaded not guilty to charges of conspiracy, unlawful assembly, and belonging to a gang of unlawful society. They were all released on bail, and their next hearing is scheduled for May 8th. Nigerian law denies civil marriage to same-gender couples, and under draconian legislation passed in 2013, couples can be jailed for up to 14 years for attempting any form of same-gender union. Anyone who witnesses, abets, and aids the solemnization of a same-sex marriage or civil union can be sentenced to up to 10 years.
Private consensual adult gay sex itself is punishable by up to 14 years in prison in secular Nigeria. Punishment can be much harsher in northern areas of the country governed by Islamic law. There was a near lynching of about a dozen men accused of sodomy in northern Bauchi State in 2014. The gay couple supposedly being celebrated at that party this week managed to evade police and are in hiding at a safe house, fearing mob violence if they are discovered.
A Canadian LGBTQ rights group dedicated to defending queer people in Iran reported that more than 30 men thought to be gay were beaten and arrested this week during a violent police raid of a private party in Esfahan province. According to Canada's Iranian Railroad for Queer Refugees, police fired their guns in the air while rounding up the men, some of whom managed to escape. At least a few heterosexual men were apparently netted in the raid. The human rights NGO said that all the detainees are being charged with sodomy, drinking alcohol, and using psychedelic drugs. Each of the detainees will reportedly be forced to undergo anal examinations in order to provide evidence of homosexual acts to the court. That barbaric practice has been widely discredited as medically bogus. Several human rights groups also call the horribly invasive procedure torture. The Iranian Railroad for Queer Refugees reported that this week's detainees were also forced to write down the full names of all of their LGBTQ friends and acquaintances who themselves will presumably be subject to eventual arrest, interrogation, and detention. The Islamic Republic of Iran has a well-documented history of persecuting sexual and gender-variant minorities. Its laws punish same-gender sex with lengthy prison terms, corporal punishment, or even execution.
In other news, the police officer killed in the April 20th terrorist attack on the Champs-Élysées in Paris was also a much-admired LGBTQ rights activist. Javier Jugalet was shot in the head, and two other police officers and a bystander were wounded by the single gunman, who was killed by police as he tried to flee the area. The 37-year-old Jugalet was a member of a French association of LGBT police officers called FLAG. The group's president, Michael Boucheron, told the New York Times that Jugalay participated in the organization's protest against Russia's no-promo-homo law during the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. He was a simple man who loved his job, Boucheron said. He was really committed to the LGBT cause. Tributes to the fallen officer, who leaves behind a husband and other family members, have poured in from around the country and around the world. French President François Hollande said an official tribute is being planned. ISIS claimed responsibility for this week's attack, which took place 3 days before the first round of the French presidential election.
Now, if you poll psychiatrists, they're going to tell you that transgender is a disease.
That's U.S. President Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of the Army, Tennessee State Senator Mark Green, during a Chattanooga Tea Party meeting late last year. His anti-queer record includes sponsoring a clone of North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill. He also backed a bill that would have allowed Tennessee teachers to refuse to address any issues in the classroom that conflicted with their religious beliefs, widely viewed as an anti-LGBTQ bill, and a successful proposal that allows therapists to refuse to accept LGBTQ patients. If he's confirmed by the U.S. Senate as expected, Green will ironically replace Obama appointee Eric Fanning, the first openly gay man to serve as Army Secretary. During his tenure, Fanning helped guide the Pentagon through the end of its ban on transgender enlistees. The American Military Partner Association, the nation's largest group of LGBTQ military spouses and their families, joined several other human rights groups to express strong opposition to the Green nomination. Based on his vicious anti-LGBT record, the group said in a media statement, Mark Green cannot be trusted to ensure all those who serve have the support they need and deserve. For the record, the American Psychiatric Association stopped listing gender identity disorder as a disease in 2012.
Meanwhile, the Alabama Supreme Court has upheld the suspension of its Chief Justice, far-right homophobe Roy Moore, citing his disregard for binding federal law. The state high court justices agreed that Moore illegally ordered probate judges in his state to ignore the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 marriage equality ruling and to deny licenses to same-gender couples. The Alabama Court of the Judiciary, the state panel that disciplines judges, ordered the suspension of Moore in September. He lost his appeal at the state Supreme Court this week. At a news conference, Moore blamed the Southern Poverty Law Center, which filed the original complaint against him, and certain transgendered and homosexual groups for his politically motivated prosecution.
I've done my duty under the laws of this state, he said, to uphold the sanctity of marriage and the undeniable truth that God ordained marriage as a union of one man and one woman. Moore, not surprisingly a Republican, is said to be considering a run for governor in 2018 or for the U.S. Senate later this year. He said he'll announce his plans sometime soon after discussions with his family.
But finally, he's a basketball legend and a tireless advocate for the rights of people living with HIV/AIDS since shocking the world in 1991 with the announcement that he's HIV positive. He's now a leading Los Angeles area businessman with additional interest in the city's Dodgers baseball and Lakers basketball franchises. Irvin Magic Johnson is also the proud father of EJ, his out and sometimes gender-bending gay son. The elder Johnson had some advice for other parents of non-conforming LGBTQ kids during his appearance on the Ellen DeGeneres Show this week.
I think it's all about you not trying to decide what your daughter or son should be or what you want them to become. It's all about loving them no matter who they are, what they decide to do. And when my son came out, I was so happy for him and happy for us as parents. And we love him. And EJ is amazing. So you got to support your child because there's so many people who try to discriminate against them. So they need you to support them. Because if you don't support them, who's going to support them and love them? You know, it's really important.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 22nd, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
There hasn't really ever been a British version of Paris is Burning or something that celebrates the UK underground scene.
Well, that's not true anymore, as you'll discover.
later in the program.
My car got stopped at a Chechen police checkpoint, and they asked me for my documents. They looked at them and said, "We are taking you."
That's the disguised voice of one of three Chechen gay refugees who spoke anonymously with CNN this week. Others told their stories to the New York Times. As This Way Out's Lucia Chappell reports, mainstream media is finally starting to pay attention.
One thing is clear. There is a concerted effort to exterminate all gay, perceived gay, and bisexual men in the predominantly Muslim Chechnya region of Russia. Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov proudly admitted to the genocidal campaign this week. The pal of Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to rid his area of all gay and bisexual men before the observance of Ramadan at the end of May. As of this report, well over 100 men have been rounded up and detained in what are increasingly being called gay concentration camps, the first in Europe since the Nazis did it more than 75 years ago. Lured in by entrapment through fake romantic social media exchanges, detainees are being tortured to extract the names of their friends and acquaintances. The Chechen men featured on CNN this week were among the lucky ones to have escaped to underground safe houses in Moscow. Another disguised gay Chechen survivor told CNN about his experience.
They started beating me with their fists and feet. They wanted to get names of my gay friends from me. Then, they tied wires to my hands and put metal clippers on my ears to electrocute me. They've got special equipment which is very powerful. When they shock you, you jump high above the ground.
A spokesman for Chechen President Kadyrov claimed last week that no gays are being persecuted in Chechnya because there are no gays there. Following up on that preposterous assumption, Kadyrov himself whined this week that he's the victim of a smear campaign by human rights groups. Those claims went unchallenged when he was interviewed by the Russian government-sponsored TV network RT late this week.
The whole world has united against our country, against the nation. They seek every opportunity to counter Putin. The name Kadyrov is heard everywhere, but nothing is said about those who are corrupt. There is no evidence of any crime that they accuse me of. Every day they write articles on nonsense, not backed by anything. Every time it's something new. The national and local press discuss it. And I'm saying, prove it. If you don't have proof, then I'm not guilty.
Putin Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov insisted late this week that investigators have found no evidence to support the claims of the purge and that the Russian leader has no reason to doubt Kadyrov's repeated denials. Human Rights Watch has documented at least three deaths in the homophobic pogrom so far, one who died during torture, and two others were victims of so-called honor killings by shamed family members after their release from detention. So, as a third relatively safe in Moscow survivor of the genocidal campaign told CNN this week,
if my family finds out that I'm gay, then no authorities, no troops are needed. They will kill me themselves. Even if my parents will forgive me, someone, like my uncle, won't forgive.
The reporter who first broke the news about the gay purge has fled the country. A jihad was issued against Elena Milishina and those she works with at the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta for tarnishing the honor of the Chechen nation. Milishina told the Washington Post this week that she'll continue to do her job despite the death threats. Today or tomorrow, she said, the Kremlin will have to deal with the situation. Reporting for This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
I'm Roman Kalinin from Moscow. You are listening to This Way Out,
the showpiece of the homosexual movement in the United States.
Оставайтесь на нашей волне.
Stay on our wavelength.
While the drag world in the States may plant its pumps on the pop side, the London scene is more powered by punk. The writer-director of an award-winning documentary about that scene brought three of his stars to the last DragCon in Los Angeles, where This Way Out's Michelle Marie Gilkison explored their fabulousness.
I'm the director of the film, Colin Rothbart.
Why did you make the film? What was your goal?
I was on holiday with Holstein, actually, about 7 years ago now in India. And we were in the sea and she suddenly said, oh, do you know what? There hasn't really ever been a British version of Paris is Burning or something that celebrates the UK underground scene. And we always saw people out and about with cameras and it seemed that, you know, nothing was really ever happening to this footage. And I thought, well, that's a bit weird, really. So I thought, I will, you know, start filming performances. And I went down to Glastonbury where the guys here do a thing called the Down Low. And it took a long time to win people's trust. Obviously, I knew Holstein. And Amber only came on board, for example, after we'd been filming for about a year or so, because she wasn't living in London. And then we thought, oh, she's got a great story to tell as well. Yeah, it was always to try to celebrate this scene. You know, we all look back now on Paris is Burning and think, oh, thank God that was captured. Otherwise, you know, if you don't see it, you know, it's sort of like in your mind didn't really exist. And so for people that are here today who haven't experienced London, this is an authentic slice of London at its high point, really.
Me, I'm John Sizzle. That's quite an important thing. That's what I sort of take out, well, hope a lot of people take out from the film, not just the fact that I'm HIV positive and I'm nearly 50. I prefer the whole sort of Waltons aspect of it. It's a real buzzy community. We all knew each other. We were all coming together at that time and we're all feeding off each other's excitement. Other sort of global phenomena that the world might recognise the Brits for, things like punk or the New Romantics. I think what was going on with us in the early noughties was basically the beginning of a new movement, which Johnny brought to the fore. Johnny Wu had come back from New York, where he was doing some real avant-garde alternative performance using drag. And when he came back, he started doing it in a local pub and acting like a magnet, and people were joining him and bringing their own version of creativity to his stage. And that just grew, and it became this really natural, organic movement of real punky drag queens. There was so much love around. It's not a commune as such, or a clique, but it was a bit like
community.
It was a community, but that's just like a bit of a dull word. Community is a bit worthy. We were laughing like drains. We were arguing. There were tears. There were people like having complete hissy fits and being ridiculous.
But people were there for each other. Just like when Amber wanted to raise money for her boobs, she had a boobathon, and then she raised about £4,500, which paid for most of the boobs, didn't it?
Yeah,
and that just shows that how much love there is, obviously, on the scene for you, and also for the people that make people have so much fun in East London, doesn't it?
And I think for our drag family as well. I know you hear, like, especially over here, like with RuPaul's Drag Race, there's like drag mummies and then like their offspring and that kind of thing, and I get that completely, but with us it's much more a real kind of thing. It's much more of a kind of honest thing. It's not just about helping each, you know, like saying, hey, this is my look, you're going to be the protege of my look. We're actually genuinely and really helping each other with real life issues. And
if you want some American reference points, I think we're a bit more John Walters about it. There's a lot of dysfunction, which is normal. There's quite a few gargoyles in the gang. You know, there's people are nuts. We celebrate that. I mean, if anything, it makes it more rounded. And you sort of, you learn from it. And it makes it a lot more interesting, actually. I mean, I love my nutbags.
There's a line in the film, performers are all insecure creatures. Holstein says that.
I think with performers, we have a mask, and that's what we give to the audience. And we're all fragile, genuine people underneath with emotions, and we're a hot mess of real life. We're real people. The whole point is getting on stage, performing. Your vulnerabilities at home, you deal with that when you go home.
For some of us, actually, performance actually makes us a little bit more secure, knowing that you're getting loved and adorned and worshipped and stuff. When you're out there, you can actually come away and come off stage and think, oh, wow, you know, I was feeling a little bit terrible today, and I've just done a great performance. And so an uplifting thing.
I think as well, like Amber was saying, that it's a scary place to be on the stage on your own performing. And if you're a really insecure person, that's a very tough thing to do. And I think that to get on that stage takes quite a lot of self-awareness and strength. And as you go along performing, you become stronger and stronger. So it's not just about the adulation of the audience. Sometimes it's a lot of it is about forcing yourself into situations to help yourself grow and become a stronger person.
It's also pushing it down, because you can't go on stage, get all the applause and walk off stage and still think you're amazing, because that is fake, it's fleeting. So it's good to kind of go, yes, I was good, and put it down and move on to the next show. Or even when it's a bad show, you kind of go, okay, whatever, move on and go back and sit in my boxer shorts with my dog, and that's real life. But just keep on going, because some people can go crazy for being performers because they just believe the hype, they believe the applause, and that's not real. It's fabulous, but it's not real.
It's your work. I mean, you can go home and congratulate yourself for winning a case if you're a lawyer, or you can go home, you're a midwife, you've delivered a couple of sextuplets or two, and you haven't run anyone over in driving school. You know, you can congratulate yourself, but ultimately, if you're a performer, especially a drag performer, don't believe the hype, because you will end up very disappointed once the Botox wears off, you know?
Which brings me to another point in the film about drag being a young person's game.
Why are you looking at me? I'm 17. Well, my drag age is 15, I think. It's a young person's game to a certain extent. A lot of drag is about excitement and the thrill of the new. And I suppose as you do things over and over again, the excitement of that wears off. So as you get older, you just think, oh my God, just let the kids do it. But in the movie, when I talk about that, I think the thing is I was getting a bit trapped by drag. Drag was doing me as opposed to me doing drag. And as I put my fees up and started getting more money, I started to enjoy it a bit more, I think. But I suppose...
It's the late nights.
Yeah, it's the late nights, it's the alcohol, it's... You have to watch yourself. I mean, and you need a lot of excitement to give a lot of excitement. And these kids are throwing themselves on the floor. You will not see me doing that. I might throw up on the floor, but I won't throw myself on the floor.
Give him a few, like, sandy boozes, though, and I think you probably would see him doing that.
And there's only so much of your physical self you're prepared to give up for drag.
Scotty talks in the film about a sense of control over the viewer or the audience. Can you talk about if drag is seen as a way of controlling something for each of you?
Ooh, it is, isn't it? I mean, you are create... If you've got something to say... You're creating a world in which to say it. You're a spokesperson. You are a politician. You have got everyone's attention.
What have you got to say?
We're just showing people the London side of drag, because obviously the whole world is seeing American drag, which is absolutely amazing, but it's very American. There's a London sensibility.
Very polished.
Very polished, but there's a sensibility around it as well. I mean, I'm here at this convention trying to work out exactly what it is, because I'm seeing it live. It's basically like... a Spice Girls show concert. It's like everyone is so enthusiastic for it. You won't get this in London.
No.
You won't get this type of gentleness around it. I think there's a lot more... It's a bit scratchier in London, the drag scene.
I think in London, though, we focus more on performance, variety of performance, because American drag, as fabulous as it is very much like a polished look and looking... flawless and camera ready and the lip syncing, whereas we kind of sing more, there's more comedians, there's more people actually doing magic, doing all different, you know, creating their own music as well. So we're kind of like far more driven creatively than just the look, because if you've seen the film, we all look like a bunch of hot messes rolling around a field. There's some glamorous people like Amber, of course, but the rest of us are just a fraggy hot mess. Nothing's good or nothing's bad, everything's valid. There's a bit of drag for everyone.
What do you think of the looks, though, Amber? Because here it's quite different. It's quite macabre.
There's one thing of actually getting dressed up and doing your da-da, this is me, this is my outfit, but then have you got anything to actually say and any message to give out rather than I'm fabulous and stuff, so...
And that's what we tried to, like, you know, make the film be about as well, rather than it just being, like, a home video for the scene in East London. Everyone here has got, like, their own story to tell. So whether it's, like, Amber going through her transitioning, John talking about, you know, ageism or HIV, or Holstar talking about, obviously, like, you know, having a tranny with a fanny and, like, being a woman who loves drag.
A fanny being a...
It means something quite different in the UK.
Vagina.
Yeah. A lady part, lady garden. Then also celebrating a scene which, when we were filming, thankfully was at its high point. So, you know, it's documenting it for the future.
It seems like there's definitely this inclusiveness in the film, that the fact that we have people who are transitioning and there's never a question of, do you belong here?
Yeah.
And that there are trannies with fannies, and that you can tell there's a little bit of tension from time to time, but it's never a question of, are you one of us?
Gender doesn't define what you do. Everyone says to be a drag queen, you've got to be a man in a frock. And people say, are you a bio queen? Are you a faux queen? No, I'm a drag queen. I'm a drag performer. And last year I won this award, Best Drag Act at London Cabaret Awards. And people kicked off. People are, oh my God, it's a woman. It's like, I do the same job as you. I just don't tuck and my titties are real. Everything else I do is I'm projecting, I'm taking on different energies. It's still drag. What's in my pants is no one else's business. Are you entertained? That's all I care about. If not, I'll give you your money back. There you go.
We want to raise awareness so that people all around the world can hopefully get inspired. And I know that that was one of the reasons why you, Amber, wanted to do it too, wasn't it? So that someone would be, you know, maybe watching this in Nigeria or in Russia, places where, you know, maybe transitioning is so much harder. This will hopefully help them on their way.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the one main reason why I got involved in the movie at the very beginning.
Has your relationship to the meaning of drag evolved at all?
Not necessarily. It's still all about a performance and it's all about giving what you want. But going through my transition and stuff like that, I guess I personally see myself more now as a performer rather than a drag performer. I'm trying to kind of like lose that kind of aspect to my performance. I want to kind of like cross over into more of a kind of like a mainstream, broader section of people. And I think that has very much come from a deep-rooted sense of going through a lot of personal things myself and a lot of working out to do myself with my transition and where I think I fit in society. Absolutely, our movie is very much a positive message about doing things for yourself and getting out there and
staying true to yourself.
Staying true to yourself.
Don't hide, have a wonderful time and be fabulous.
And come to the Glory in East London and have a drink on John Sizzle.
And remember, folks, don't do drugs, stick to drag.
That was Dressed as a Correspondent, Michelle Marie Gilkison, in conversation with Dressed as a Girl producer-director Colin Rothbart and stars John Sizzle, Amber Ways, and Holstar. For more information about the doc and its soundtrack, visit dragmovie.com. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jessica Andrea, Michael LeBeau, Lucia Chappell, and Michelle Marie Gilkison contributed program material. With thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. You heard War Boy featuring Johnny Woo and Holstar singing the title cut from the Dressed as a Girl soundtrack, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com. Or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, 3GCR Morwell, Victoria, Gay SA Radio, Pretoria, South Africa, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If the state, the nation state, isn't working, isn't on the side of social justice, then what do we do? Do we seek a return to the welfare state, or do we work towards something else? Do we confront the state head on, or do we work around it by creating pockets of community that put into practice values different than those propagated by neoliberal securitized regimes? Robert Latham is a political theorist who's written a provocative book about what has worked and what is working today to foster fundamental social transformation. In The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state, Robert Latham puts forward a notion of recollective passage, which involves turning away from dominant socio-political relations and enacting new ways to organize and reorganize collective life. The book is framed as a dialogue between Latham and another person, a fictional person named Mr. V. Robert Latham is an associate professor at York University in Toronto, where he teaches in the political science, communication and culture, and social and political thought programs. When Robert joined me from a studio on the York University campus, I asked what he saw as the overall project of his book.
It really starts from two different political perspectives. And one perspective on the part of this Mr. V is a commitment to the social democratic state and society, a desire to return to what was understood as emerging out of the earlier 20th century from, let's say, the Great Depression onward, the FDR regime, and all the various welfare state concepts and practices that came about, and a commitment to an emerging post-war celebration of labor and rights and work that was part of this bargain that took place after the war, the Second World War, versus another attitude which says, well, we really can't go home again, so to speak, that not only was the social democratic state or welfare state or liberal democratic state seen as resting, let's say, on an imperial system and on deep exploitation of labor and racism, sexism, go on with those sort of lists. On the other hand, it really doesn't work for advancing human progress, rights, justice, equality. And that's the basic starting point of the book.
Tell us more about what you don't like about welfare capitalism, about, you know, the social democratic state as you've defined it. Because a lot of people would say, well, you know, that was a pretty good time after the New Deal. And, you know, there was sort of a, you know, workers were treated better and there was less inequality. There was a more egalitarian distribution of income and wealth back then, let's say in the 1950s. So why don't you want to go back to that system?
Yes, I think there was more equality just because there was less inequality, which has become obviously much more pronounced and profound now. But as I mentioned, if you think about all the various forms of racism and exclusions that took place, not only for, let's say, Aboriginal communities, Native Americans, but for African Americans, Latinos, what was underneath all of that, mostly white privileged celebration of working class or middle class sort of white collar, that the disparity of their pay compared to the top executives was not as great. What actually sat there was a profound sense of inequality, great limits that were put on what could happen and what could not happen, what the possibilities were. I mean, we're in the middle of a Cold War. Most of this welfare state was actually operating with the Cold War, enacting the Cold War, emerging out of World War II. So war footing for this, the military-industrial complex was a strong part of it. Deep entrenched bureaucracies, large corporations that were roaming around the world exploiting resources and communities, millions and millions of deaths, destruction. So for me, that is enough of a kind of damnation for it to say, wait a second here, just going back to that and just returning there doesn't seem to work. So that's the problem I see, basically, and whether or not we can actually organize differently, think in different ways in terms of harnessing the energies on the left. That's the other side of it, where let's really take seriously these possibilities other than that return to the welfare state.
Now, you find hope in what you call recollective passage, and we'll be focusing a lot on that term and what it means during the course of the hour. But I want to start with deployments, because you speak of a sort of passage away from deployments. If we start with that term, deployments, do you mean by that the array of forces deployed by the state?
Yes, exactly. That's what I see as the core logic, that really, if you think about the state, we can understand it, obviously, in legal and symbolic terms, I mean, all sorts of forms of institutionalization and organization of an identity for a territory and forms of power and military force and so on. There's that level. But there's also the material level of the state, which has been emphasized for a long time, in 150 years. I mean, Marx and many other radicals of the 19th century, including some of the anarchists, made a lot of effort to pinpoint these things, the courts, the military, the police, and so on, all these various institutions, these real material forces that we might call, you know, forces on the ground. And if you think about the state, that it's really present through a deployment, some center, I mean, typically, let's say in the U.S. case, Washington, D.C., sends a piece of itself, some office somewhere, to another space. It's not unlike, in some way, the way that you see a imperial force sends a piece of itself, an army, a colony, to another space. So the federal government, for example, sends a certain office and group out to North Dakota, opens up a certain office, right? Enters that space. So this is really how it's organized in the material way. If we look around, well, where's the state, right? We see it in these various pockets of bureaucracy, of administrators, of offices. So those are deployed. And I'm using that word just to convey the military sense, right? We talk about military deployment. So it's a way of understanding the state as a kind of quintessentially military form. And because of that, it raises the problem of whether or not, however well-intentioned, however justice-oriented your approach to the state is, if you're resting on that model, if that's how you're going to always relate to individuals, to communities, to spaces, then that's going to cause a problem for anybody who's seeking actually to change things and see the real justice that they're after.
Now, the state, the nation state in the U.S. and many other nations operates under what's called a neoliberal economic regime. It's not just an economic regime, a neoliberal economic political regime. And you're right, the passage starts from conditions like neoliberalism. Let me get your definition of neoliberalism.
I take neoliberalism as a, and there's many ways to understand it, I can't go through it, but I understand it in a sense intuitively as an attempt to harness the state to advance financialization, privatization, corporate power, the use of all forms of the state's apparatus, from infrastructure like water, electricity, for the advantage and the benefit of corporations. In some cases, it is so-called marketizing things, creating a market for something. For in many cases, we're not dealing with really markets. We're dealing with corporate power, very hierarchical forms of control, inside deals made between parties of the state, parties of corporations. And that, to me, is a kind of essential way of understanding it, and also intuitively to see what's really going on here in the end and what's different from a non-neoliberal form where you're actually dealing with, let's say, forms of public control of resources, bounded sectors where corporate power cannot enter or be determining or taking over resources and shaping the actual economic life and so on. So that's where there's a difference. So not that under non-neoliberalism, pre-neoliberalism, there wasn't lots of corporate power and capital was not essential. It's just that it reached a point where it could go into the state and, in a sense, use the state for advancing all of the things I mentioned, the privatization and the advancement of corporate power and so on, the colonization of sectors of life, for economics, for consumption, and so on, for finance, massive systems of finance and complicated arrangements that we associate with things like derivatives and forms of debt and so on. Those were all part of the package. And I think that was the kind of revolution that was central in neoliberalism, was to say, wait a second, it's not just about, you know, having more markets and arguing for markets in distinction to the state. It's by, let's go into the state, let's really now exploit it. And lots of state exploitation happened through the centuries, and you can look at some of the histories of the 19th century and see what happened with railroads and canals. And we have depressions in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where we see massive financial power at play. But this became a systematic transformation, and it obviously was global. And it was really became organized as a way of doing things differently, not just pockets of difficult and troubling outcomes with large financial firms and J.P. Morgan or large corporations and Mellon and so on. This was of a different order. Continuous with that past, of course, but a sort of qualitative shift that became quite different.
Robert Latham joins us on Against the Grain. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto, and he's author of The Politics of Evasion, a Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. It's recently out from Routledge. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica. And to continue and perhaps begin to wrap up our discussion of some foundational issues or aspects, hypersecurity, so that, again, you're right, the passage, which is what you're interested in describing and advocating for in this book, starts from neoliberalism and conditions like hypersecurity. by which you mean?
Yeah, cybersecurity, again, like neoliberalism, there's a major shift, a qualitative transformation in the treatment of security as internal to forms of life that hadn't been, in a sense, subject to it the way it had in the past. So most obvious example is all the forms of surveillance that are being carried out by organizations like the National Security Agency, and we obviously see the revelations of Snowden, Edward Snowden. We've seen interesting things from WikiLeaks and other whistleblowers of various form. That's entering into a level of security that is much greater than it was in the past. It's also with hypersecurity, as I term it, we're also, in a sense, making it far more central a category for any government agency to actually evaluate what they're doing or not doing and making judgments about what's at stake, understanding the border. It's not just about governing a population, but carrying out very intensive security policies, and we're seeing that now today, maybe carried to a extreme of the Trump administration. And it's a good example of, if you look at a just a little antidote, if you look at a movie from the 1950s and you look at border crossing, you'll see people basically showing up in some cases, let's say from Mexico, in their car and saying, oh, I'm an American citizen. Okay, where do you live? And maybe looking at a document and perhaps not even just going based on what they understand to be an American accent. That versus what we now see at the level of scrutiny and so on tied to security logic. So that's a pointed example of what we're talking about. We've reached a different level, just like with neoliberalism. It's continuous with the history of capitalism, but it's shifted and organized in a different way that we can understand as a qualitative difference, and the intensification is noticeable.
So, you know, we have all these things, these systems, these regimes that you don't like. And a lot of people would say, in fact, the interlocutor, your interlocutor in this book, The Politics of Evasion, which is framed as a dialogue between you and an imaginary Mr. V, a fictional Mr. V, he believes that then what you need to do is you need to take the state and get rid of it in its current form and replace it with something much better, more socially just. And yet, in this book, you are advancing a notion of passage, as I mentioned before. Is this a passage away, a movement away from the circumstances and institutions you've been describing?
Yes, that's a good way to look at it. It is a movement away. I mean, the image I always keep in my mind is like a black hole. Think of a plane of some space. Let's say that plane is social and political life, let's say in the United States. And you open up a space, you try to break away from that plane, and the sort of hole opens up and you move away into another future. Now imagine that that plane becomes populated with lots of these kind of black holes, so to speak. And the terrain starts changing. You start transforming. And so the reality of what's faced by any political actor, economic actor even, is changed. So it's different. That it's no longer as coherent as it once was. So those passages are about trying to move. I use the word deflection, deflect away, doing something different, sort of bouncing off of the existing form, deflecting from, turning away from that existing practice. And there's very mundane examples and very complicated examples. One of the most simple examples I ever think of is community banking. Think of a group in, let's say, the Midwest community that says, well, we're no longer going to send our money to Wall Street. We're going to keep the money in the community or in the state, the region, the county, and so on. That's a deflection. You've now shifted. Now imagine that we had lots of these things going on. You saw an explosion. There was a scale-up of this practice. And as we know, there are organizations that are trying to advance this, and there is a history of this that goes way back, even into the 19th century, and in terms of farms and the granges and so on. But imagine that we start to see a real kind of proliferation. So that terrain begins to shift. In a sense, the holes begin to emerge. It's no longer as coherent as it was, let's say, if you're sitting somewhere in a large bank, and you're thinking of why are we now missing these funds, or why are these communities organizing differently? Why are they spending in different ways, and why do they have access to the money? Why is it not in our accounts the way it was 5 years ago? Why are they not borrowing from us? So that begins to transform. So that's one level of the passage, and there's the more radical dimensions as well. But that's another story where it goes from the other sort of arc of recollectivization, moving from the mundane example to the far more complicated examples of, let's say, large-scale social revolutions, like, let's say, in Cuba or other places.
So you would call the Cuban Revolution an example of what you term recollective passage. What is the recollective part of that phrase? What does that mean?
The recollective really reflects the notion that any group collective that's in a sense trying to deflect away, do things differently, finding a logic of difference, or finding lots of logics of difference, in the case of, let's say, Cuba, they're moving in another direction, they're reorganizing, they're devising other ways of organizing all the sectors of their life, their material and possibly cultural life. They're reforming their collective. Now, that's clear in terms of a large-scale revolution, as in the Cuban case, but they're also recollectivizing when that community, let's say in North Dakota, decides to set up a community bank. They are organizing it differently. It's a much more shallow version of it, and it's more, let's say, one-dimensional, dealing with, let's say, collective funds that the community has, but it's also a transformation. It's recollecting. Now, so this is sort of this kind of wide range or arc of recollectivity, as one might say, starting from narrow or mundane to the far more radical and wide scale. But what's unique is the attempt to point to this deflecting and devising away. So recollectivizing also reflects the idea that we would look back at existing resources that are our histories, what we have, our lands, whatever, homes and things, and reorganizing that to recognize them for what they are, bring them into this new collectivity that we organize. So it's not just a open to the future and the past means nothing. It is also something where the past does mean things, but it gets put back into reconsideration and reorganizing through this attempt to think of the collective and sit down with all of our existing forms and resources and material forms of life and cultural and symbolic, and saying, how can we organize this differently where we, the large collective, is treated in an equal way, in a just way? And the idea is also the re-notion, and where the passage comes in that's very important to that, is that it's moving into the future, that has to be left open. Open into the future. It's a never-ending process. Once you decide that it's over, we've done. We're finishing here. This is good enough. Then, in a sense, you've stopped that possibility of recollectivity. You've formed, and you're just trying to consolidate and make it better, which risks not just the power of the bureaucracy taking over and just saying, well, we're going to administer life as is, but power forms, individuals, groups emerging who are saying, well, we're the ones that we're going to decide how this works best. We are the experts and so on. You really don't have any say because there's nothing open anymore. The way the world is this. So, and the thing is, when you mentioned Cuba, I mean, the cases in a sense, they did decide, okay, this is how it is, basically. I think they kept to some degree going on, but in many ways they kind of locked in the system. So that's the key, is despite our desire for, let's say, the radicality of early Cuban Revolution, the question is, can it keep moving and changing and transforming, despite also the conditions that it always has to face? It's not easy. It's not something where people are just sitting around putting their things together and rethinking. They're facing lots of pressures. They're facing lots of counter forces, counter-revolution, constant challenge, fight back, and so on. So though the key is how one keeps things open, how does the collective, how does the individuals a part of this departure and that are going down the passage, how are they always feeling, hey, wait a second, we can sit down and we can organize this way, we can organize that way. Or some of the examples during, let's say, Chavez's time in office, where there were lots of these communes and various organizations that were constantly operating with this kind of logic, I think.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Latham joins us. He teaches in the Political Science, Communication and Culture, and Social and Political Thought programs at York University. He's the author of The Liberal Moment and, most recently, The Politics of Evasion, a Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. Robert joins me today to talk about his new book, The Politics of Evasion. So, recollective passage. Nothing personal, Robert, but it's a bit clunky, and it might not grab people and catch on, but maybe it will, and maybe this conversation will help in that process. Why create a new term and concept, in a sense, although maybe I'm beginning to answer your question for you, but why create this new term when we have terms already like social revolution or radical social movements or prefiguration, which is often used to describe the effort to point to and put into practice desired ways of living and organizing, which I think must be part of recollective passage? Why create this new term and not just piggyback on an existing term?
The main motive is to find some of the common elements among all the different forms that you just described, and to distinguish those common elements from the things that fall outside of that. So if we can see the common elements between a social movement that is trying to change the logics of how things are organized, like change the way the border is organized, or do something as simple as change the way land and how people live, you know, say the squatters movement, that could be related to, let's say, large-scale revolution or back to the community banking, to see that common element, which is that recollectivity. And perhaps recollectivism or recollectivity may be a better way to think of it than just the notion of the passage. I mean, the idea of the passage is just to emphasize that this is meant to move through the future and meant also to show that these things have to have a certain bounding. And I use the word shielding in a way, because we can't just assume everything's going to be fine and open and not to be subject to forms of capture and forms of subversion by the state, various other forces that would want to do that. So these passages, and I'm in a sense inspired in that way by Walter Benjamin in his thinking of the passages, and he just was looking at commercial passages in France particularly, but also in his work and thinking, he pointed to the way these things got subverted, sometimes used in revolt and rebellion, or the way workers had used the passages differently than they had been intended, and so on. So, but the idea of the passage is that you are moving into the future, that you have an existing trajectory, that you're on a trajectory of transformation. So social movements, for example, organizing to, let's say, push for better policy on CO2 emissions or something of that nature, or water pollution, or let's say a change in the wage of something. Those are, in a sense, different. Those type of pressures on policy, distinct from this idea that we're actually focused on changing the logics, how things work, how they're organized. And sometimes, again, they can be small. So, again, thinking of the community banking example, or the wide-scale examples of, let's say, the Paris Commune, where they consciously there in 1871, you know, kind of 72, were organizing for this. And basically, once they finally got into their autonomy during the Commune, they were able to, in a sense, totally change the nature of how decisions are made, democracy operated, the relationship between what could be seen as representatives and the people, wages, and so on. They completely transformed that. So that's the emphasis. So the recollectivity is trying to emphasize that. That's different than, let's say, for example, a revolt or a rebellion or something like L.A. 1992. You know, important expression of terrible frustration, anger, and politics as well. But it's quite different than this idea of people self-consciously trying to move forward in transforming and putting the emphasis on those changes in transforming and things that actually say we are changing the collectivity, whether it's a small organizational thing or a large one. As I mentioned, it's still part of the same basic distinct form that's quite different than these other protests or types of mobilizations or networking to pressure, right, or marching down the street with banners and so on. I'm not in any way denigrating any of those other forms. I'm just pointing to something distinct that also is operating in these forms, let's say, broadly speaking, of resistance and attempts to transform social life.
But it's not just people who, let's say, reside on the left who want to change society, who want to transform power relations or, you know, social relations. I mean, there are a lot of people on the right. There are a lot of libertarians who want a transformation of society and are working toward it and are mobilizing and are in some cases demonstrating. Do these folks also fit within your passage idea?
Well, in a sense, they do at the very beginning, the starting point of saying, well, yes, this is attempt to reorganize. The problem is that they don't really have an interest in being recollective in any way, right? They want to achieve a certain type of society, and then they're done, which may resemble what we were talking about in terms of inclinations on the left that also want to achieve one certain sort of society, one way of organizing, and then kind of done, right? And if you look at any, you know, let's say Iran or the Iranian Revolution, 1979 and so on, they weren't seeking to open up a passage, a form of transformation going forward, of recollectivizing, of recollectivity. They were interested in creating the society that we have been watching unfold in the last decades. Any other movement on the right, say a conservative movement, the very notion of being conservative is about conserving, to create a certain type of society. Fixed notions go in. Yes, they change organizational logics, but they're really only interested in creating the particular form that they have modeled and so on. So, yes, as they go along, of course, they'll make changes, they'll do reforms and so on, but they're after one particular model. So the idea of the recollectivism is really about keeping it open so that the people, if I can use that term, are always, in a sense, and have to be open to possibly of changing again, holding things open to question and having the ability to say, wait a second, this is not going the way we intended, or this is leaving us out, or it's excluding us, it's non-democratic and so on. This has nothing to do with the two examples that I have in mind that I mentioned before with, let's say, certain forms of conservative right or the Iranian religious forms, very deeply orthodox forms, right? They're exactly in the other direction, even though they open up a space of transformation. So they do change. They create one moment in a sense of recollective in the sense and it's over. So there's no passage, which is why having that qualifier of passage in the sense to understand what real recollectivism rests on is the ability to keep going into the future, always putting things at stake, and always leaving up that possibility, leaving open that possibility of yet again transforming. So I think that helps to distinguish what we understand as kind of right revolutions versus, let's say, left revolutions. And the left, I think that was very much consistent with many things that Marx had said in the sense of not being willing to say, well, here's what the new society should be, and criticizing any group and any ideologues that try to say, here's what it is, here's the seven principles, and let's just put them into action. And he had ideas of how it should be, notions of communal relationships to land and resources and so on, and the nature of work. Yes, he had principles, but that was different than actually modeling a society. So he was a real recollectivizer in a sense, in his logic, I would argue.
That's the voice of Robert Latham. He's associate professor of political science at York University, and he's author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. We'll take a short break and speak more with Robert about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Latham, he teaches in the political science, communication and culture, and social and political thought programs at York University. He's my guest today, and his new book is called The Politics of Evasion. It's recently out from Routledge. And on againstthegrain.org, you will find a link to his faculty page. It's L-A-T-H-A-M, by the way, his last name. You'll find a link to Robert Latham's faculty page at York University, as well as to the book, The Politics of Evasion. So by stressing, Robert, a kind of movement away from this system of neoliberalism and hypersecurity, as opposed to maybe a more confrontational approach, an attempt to maybe take down the state, you know, it smacks of anarchism, right? It smacks of being anti-state, not just anti this state, this neoliberal state, but not wanting a state in place. Is that fundamentally where your political instincts lie?
Not quite. I'm really, I say, on the cusp of both anarchism, socialism, and seeking ways that we can really learn from both of the traditions. And I think that really one of the key things for me is to recognize that, and as David Harvey, I think, pointed out, if I recall correctly, that even when you start talking about federation and you start talking about reaching a level where you have, let's say, autonomous communities that we understand in a kind of anarchist way that are trying to connect to each other, right? Because people aren't going to just sit there in their local communities and not try to create a world, a region, and so on. They have no choice. I mean, to survive and so on, and to enrich their lives, they want to be doing that. Once you get to that level, then you start possibly actually, in a sense, recreating a state, even if you don't call it that. You start having rules for relationships, for exchange, and so on. So I'm really working in my mind at that juncture where we really can't necessarily get to the point where we have a sort of pure anarchism per se. We work at the cusp, and I think it's an interesting place to be because it opens up the best of what we can bring from anarchism and the best that we can bring from even notions of state socialism. And I think there's a way of understanding the state differently, that we don't have to have the state of deployments, the one that we have rested on for a long time through the centuries and has developed into a pretty intense machine as it currently exists. We could possibly have a state that is shot through with these different recollective forms that is open to, in a sense, being a recollective state. And I think I get inspiration there from Gramsci, where he talked about kind of the integral state, which combines civil society and political society, political forms and civil forms. The only thing is he went to the party and saw it as the emergence of a party state, and I would see it as an emergence of a state that's committed to the ethics of recollectivity, to recollectivism. So that it would be open, that it would be one where it was constant public involvement in shaping the policies and so on. I mean, it's beyond just participation. I think that looking back and seeing the incredible ethic and mind frame that we saw in the Paris Commune, as I mentioned, 1871, that there was a real kind of almost short-lived way that they actually put together this kind of form of a weak collective state in a way. So we actually have that as a model, I think, on one level. The question is, though, there's a bigger, wider world out there, and the forces that ended the commune, that were organized against it and destroyed it, are still out there. So the question then is, how do we start building these recollective forms that start changing the social terrain and the economic form, the political forms? We deal with the state. We don't ignore it. And that's where I think I don't believe in the notions of changing the world and without taking power and so on. I think that we have to confront the forms of power. It's not an either or. I'm partly in this book, one of the main missions is to avoid and get over the either ors that dominate a lot of our politics.
So you have said a number of times this hour, you've spoken about openness and how important openness is to the movement, the passage that you are advocating. And your interlocutor, your fictional interlocutor in this book, Mr. V, because this book is framed as a dialogue between you and this Mr. V, he has a lot of problems with that because openness implies a kind of indeterminacy. It suggests kind of an untethering from certain sort of bedrock principles that might unite people. So you might have all these different passages happening in society. But then if everyone's sort of open to revision and to reconceptualization and to a renewed kind of a different kind of strategizing than the current one, then it can get kind of, you know, chaotic and diffuse and confused and incoherent, that these various passages won't cohere in a way that will in fact lead to a recollectivized society. How do you respond to that?
Yes, and I would add that also the indeterminacy that's tied to an openness could be seen and is seen by the interlocutor as something that doesn't emphasize the bedrock of achieved results, right? No one wants part-time human rights. No one wants to reverse and see flux and so on, right? Because as we know, that's what something that we thought about in terms of capitalism is, you know, everything solid melts in the air and so on, right? These sort of things that have been thought of, Marx that put it that way, and others have talked about this form. And basically the problem is that indeed we don't want to see that. So the one way of dealing with that in thinking about that, because that is the problem, if we leave things open and put them up for grabs, so to speak, we risk, right? We risk putting our achievements, whatever social justice we've achieved, up for grabs. And one response to that is that, one, the idea is not that the past is gone and everything's up for grabs. If people, in their rethinking of their collective, as they collectivize, recollectivize, they actually think of these past things as part of their resources in history. So they bring the things that they want to have in the new collective, the new form that they're reorganizing. And whether it's a broad version of reorganizing, even a small one, so women's rights and various other forms of sexual rights and things of that sort would be brought along into the other forms so that that history gets carried. It's less risky, in a sense, than one might think. Yes, there's risks. Then there's no way to avoid the risk, unfortunately. Anytime you open up a moment, any revolutionary moment, unfortunately, there is the risk that those who have very narrow, closed notions of power or society will take over. Again, Iran, thinking of that revolution, how many people were involved, let's say, from communist trajectory, other form, other radical allegiances were part of that revolution, and yet it ended up leading towards the current regime. And so this is always the problem. I mean, if any transformation, you open up the moment and you're also becoming a little vulnerable to it's settling and capturing, being captured by certain power forces. So the question is to think about what it means to open and who's in charge of the opening, and keeping in mind, wait a second here, we have to have a process for going forward. If we don't institutionalize the recollectivizing, we have to institutionalize that recollectivizing, then if we don't do that, we are vulnerable, yes, to some group consolidating and capturing the revolutionary moment or the transformative moment. And even the micro form, going back to our example of community banking, right? It's the same thing. If it doesn't, it can get captured by, you know, some form of a corporate allegiances and so on. Say, hey, okay, keeping the money in community, that's great, but you know what? Let's put them all into public-private partnerships, right? So we're always thinking about the notion of openness. We're thinking then about of how we actually we cannot limit it to public-private partnerships, and no one can say it's going to be this way and not that way. It's always us as a group, with the ever-ready possibility of reforming again, which is a principle that one hopes keeps participation for involvement in the collective, in collectivizing, at the forefront of what's taking place, which is the sort of democratic element that's inherent in this idea of recollectivity.
Robert Latham joins us. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at York University. And we're talking about his book, The Politics of Evasion, A Post-Globalization Dialogue Along the Edge of the State. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Robert, let me get back to this issue of the state, of the nation state, and how you feel about it. Because, you know, you say in some ways you want to move away from the state, but you've also told me that, you know, confronting the state is very important, and you could see a case in which a government, a state, being in passage or being open to recollective passage on the part of its residents, on the part of its people. And yet it just seems to me that given the kind of openness and flexibility and indeterminacy that you want and that would have to be part of this state, it just seems to me that, you know, it would be an incredibly rare thing for a state like this to emerge. It almost wouldn't be a state the way we think about nation states. So I just wonder whether you should just come out and say, if you believe it, that just states are inherently prone to fundamental injustice, and that to really think about a state that isn't that way is really kind of moving, is kind of a leap of faith, and it's a process of pushing our imaginations in directions that may never be achieved.
That's a fair question. I would answer it, and hopefully this is not an evasion, but I would answer it by saying that it's the state as it's currently organized and conceived is one that is inherently hurtling, despite good intentions and so on, towards injustices in these various forms that have been part of its history, even though some groups benefit at different times that are not even the top elites historically, as we spoke about earlier in terms of certain workers and so on. So the question is, how does one reorganize it? I mean, I think we have seen some examples. I mean, I think Chavez's Venezuela was trying to move towards that, made these transformations. They changed some of their the original, I think, 2001, the land law opened up the possibility of collective ownership and communal decisions over land use, domicile, and so on. It applied eventually, I think, even to the urban context not too long after that. Lots of other things were opened up, tons of communes, and there's works on this that are out there. People can find the research. And basically, we might even point even to a current example, a simple one, which is simple because the transformation is not as, let's say, radical as the Venezuelan case, Ecuador. So the current regime in Ecuador right now, I mean, made a very simple change not too long ago where they said that banks have to keep the money in Ecuador, or at least a certain large percentage, maybe as much as 60-70% at this point. And that opened up a huge amount of resources that could be invested in the public and public sphere activities, education, health, and housing, and so on. This was a good example of that exactly kind of recollectivizing that took place. They made an orthogonal kind of organizational change, altered the way that banks operate, and wow, it really led to something. Other things have taken place since then in the country. But there's an example now, where it's going and how far it's going to go with this transformation. Well, that's exactly the question of the passage, right? I mean, are they going to keep moving and rethinking and organizing how much of involvement of the collective will be in this, as opposed to right now they have a president that's pretty sophisticated and I think leading the charge in this endeavor, but that's not enough. So if he starts bringing in individuals the way we saw Chavez, you know, in a sense, organizing, facilitating, allowing, tolerating the bottom-up organization of all types of forms of collectives and communes in Venezuela, that could really be quite an interesting model if he's allowed to survive politically, because once, of course, it starts looking like it's interesting and working and wiping out poverty, dealing with inequality, well, this draws the attention of, you know, elite power structures, and of course, examples like that are not very welcome. So, however, that's, I think, the transformations that would be required. We have examples of that, again, even in these last decades. And the more of that, the more that we see leadership, and more importantly, we see cadres, individuals of society that are committed to this, I think the better chance there is of moving away from that old model that may be desirable because it's has a history and, you know, it's tied with certain type of rights and commitments to the right norms of progressivism and so on, yet as also only comes together with forms of injustices, has been copacetic with neoliberalism in deep ways, as we saw in the Clinton administration, for example. So I think that we do have that. So we do have this other model as a possibility. But people, I think, have to start thinking of the state differently and not think of the state as something that delivers, that gives you something. The state has to, in a sense, be truly captured all the way down, not just at the center, at the height of power, but has to be captured in this more decentralized way. And the society, the terrain, I would think, to the last point, most importantly, has to be changed. So that's where the recollectivities, as they try to change the social relations, change the actual terrain within which the state operates. That's most essential of all, I would think, to actually transform that so that the political parties respond differently to a different world that's beginning to emerge in various places, locales, and across the society.
Yeah, and as you write in your book, the very existence of a state can rest on a great deal of fundamental injustices, even if it veers in a progressive direction. Robert Latham is author of The Politics of Evasion, a post-globalization dialogue along the edge of the state. He's also the author of The Liberal Moment, Modernity, Security, and the Making of Post-War International Order. But the focus today has been on the politics of evasion. Robert Latham is Associate Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto, Canada. Thanks so much, Robert, for joining me.
Welcome, and thank you very much for giving me the time and your great attention.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.